You're listening to Around Comics, November 2010.
That was weak.
Really?
Yeah, it sounded weak.
What do you want?
I don't know. Boom. I want some boom. Chicago, this is Around Comics. Hey there, folks. Christopher Niesman here. It is great to be back. Great to have you listening. On this November 2010 episode, Brian Salazar and I are joined by Kyle Figley, the news editor for Comic Resources, and creator Mr. Tim Seeley. We're going to be talking about a variety of subjects, including The Walking Dead, Halloween, symbols, Hitler, Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, comic book storytelling, apples versus cake, Clint, and a whole lot more. We join the conversation in progress talking about The Walking Dead.
Yeah, man, fuck those comics.
What did you get? You watch it?
Yeah, I caught the first episode on Tuesday because I'd watch it a little later, but it yeah, I really liked it. It was really well done. I mean, you know, you get frustrated. You see, it's like, oh, it's exactly the comic, and I know now I'm always gonna have that situation where it's like, people are talking about how much they love this show, and you want to go, oh, well, that's exactly how the comic was, but I still sound like a, you know, like I'm
kind of a douchebag. Yeah, going, yeah. Oh, wow, the comic was.
But what I want to tell them is, go read the comic. But no, I think it worked really well. That was the best zombie makeup I think I've seen ever.
That's pretty sweet.
Because they just did such a realistic take on like dead corpses and stuff, which was kind of brilliant.
But Charlie Adlard even looked great.
Was he in there?
Yeah, he was. One of the last zombies that are getting off the bus that start following Rick as he's riding into
one of those kind zombies. Of sit up and
yeah, one of those zombies was Charlie Adler.
Was Kirkman a zombie?
Oh, I refused to do it. No, I
really?
Yeah, yeah. I remember somebody talking about it and he was like, "Nah, I'm not gonna be on camera. Fuck that."
Why the hell wouldn't? Because I think that a lot of people like
he has a phobia about zombies,
or just you know some. Like a lot of people,
it's
like,
not like every day you get a TV show made up.
But I mean, I think there's that weird thing where, I mean, because people always ask me, like, hey, would you be in the Hack Slash movie? I'm like, no, I'm a terrible actor. Why would I do that? You know, like, I would have no interest.
Stan Lee's
in
every Marvel
right,
movie.
Right, but he's always been.
That's why he's Stan Lee.
And he's always been like an actor, right? I mean, he wants to be an actor.
Right.
Or,
right.
I mean, not wants he's to be an actor, but. But I mean, I know that I'm not that guy, so yeah. I would never do that. I would never put some director through, like, okay, Seeley, do your line. I can't act, and I'm terrible. And then, you know what I mean? I don't want to put someone through
well,
that.
Well, you don't have to. Pull a Stephen King, really, yeah, is sure. What it is. Right. He's put himself in every... Stephen King's been in a lot of his own shit.
Yeah,
he's always just Stephen King.
Like, well, you know. Alfred Hitchcock has sure. been in all
and
of his
you know,
movies.
Or M. Night Shyamalan. To me, yeah, that always comes across, no offense to those guys, kind of douchey.
Well, I think you do it like Sam Raimi. You just put your car in every
car.
Movie.
Yeah, that's true.
That I like. I mean, yeah, or you have like a, you know, a little signature they put in something. I think that's cool. But, you know, I always thought that sort of stuff.
But to do that from the beginning kind of takes some hubris, doesn't it?
It does. And it also takes a certain amount of like, I mean, you know.
No, but that's what my point is. Like, hey, I may never get the chance again. I'm going to do it this time. You know, and that would be my thought process. Like, I don't know that I'm ever going to get a movie or anything, you know, ever again or have the opportunity to be in my own TV show. I'm going to do it this fucking time for sure. That, you know, that would be my thought process.
I certainly understand.
You dress up as a zombie like, you know, like Christmas. You put on like zombie makeup.
Yeah. I do get it would be an experience, but, you know, yeah. I would have liked to see a big old Rolly Kirkman zombie beard. I would have enjoyed that, but.
Well, see, that I think that.
Because I mean, kind of getting to the point Spawn, right?
is that like emaciated peep? Did he?
McFarlane was in Spawn?
The movie, yeah.
I don't remember.
He's a bum.
Oh, yeah, he's a bum in the alley. I remember he put himself on the cover for a while when they were doing this. He had photo covers for like the 8 months before the movie came out, and one was just picture him just whole. You know, just,
Well, you know, like thin emaciated people make really good looking zombies, and Kirkman is not that.
He's a hail and actually, butt man.
as we saw in Dawn of the Dead remake, fat ladies also make good zombies.
Okay. Well, Zombieland, you had the big fat redneck zombie running around. He was pretty good. I mean, you know, I don't think it.
I think
matters.
Kirkman could have said that. He could have had a place.
And Norton turned around and walked out.
Oh, well, you know. Did you guys? Because I read The Walking Dead obviously before I watched the show, and it had been a long time since I had read the first few issues, which the show is, or the first episode was based on.
Yeah,
like, well, issue and a half.
But even so, watching it, I knew what was going to happen the whole time. Like I knew, and it was weird watching it. It was sort of like I had a hard time judging it. Like
did,
if it was
did
good,
you watch it? Because I watched it with my wife, who hasn't read the comics, and then I was kind of pissed at her afterwards because she loved the show, and I was like, why don't you read the fucking comics? Because you love the movie. But watching with her, she was like, she got really into it. She was really like, oh, this is so tense. I don't think, she kept going, does this guy die?
Right, right.
You know? So I know it was effective. Even though, I mean, obviously for us,
we know
because
that
they didn't
Rick's
change a lot of stuff.
Die.
You know
we
what
know,
I mean? Yeah. I mean, you go see a movie of Spider-Man or something. I mean, obviously, you know, Spider-Man's going to die, but you're there. You know, it's not going to be exactly like some comic.
Right.
But this, in this case, was literally, you know, a lot of cases, panel for panel, Tony Moore stuff. So, you know.
But they did, Kirkman did say in one interview I read, he said that they are going to
change things. Yeah, and they're going to have
right? And I think they have such a great ability to do that because in that story, there's so much time that you
in between panels.
Yeah, I mean, you could go in any direction at any time and really just build a whole other story, you know.
You think at any point they're like, damn, Tony, did you have to draw so many fucking helicopters and tanks? The budget is going
out. Oh, yeah, I thought about that. Where it's like that, especially that one scene where if you were Tony, like, you know, 7 years ago and you're drawing Walking Dead, you aren't thinking about, oh, someday some poor key grip or like whatever is going to have to go get the fucking
get an
keys
Apache
to this
helicopter.
Tank. And like, you know, some location tanks. Guy is going to have to go to.
Honestly, I think that's why they've expanded the whole tank thing because the tank wasn't a big prop in the comic.
Right.
But I'm sure they're like, okay, we got to get this.
We have
we're going to pay for the tank.
We're going to use the tank.
Let's use the tank. We got the tank budget. Let's use the tank.
Yeah. The tank could have its own. It'd be the tank and The Walking Dead. I mean, this could be the star of the show. It's that expensive, so yeah.
We're paying more for the tank than most of the actors because you never heard of the actors. But
we couldn't use the helicopter. We're gonna use the tank.
I had a weird thing too with that TV show, which was, I mean, obviously I've known Kirkman for years. So I went to that awards show in Italy, and one of the actresses there. She was in like Halloween, the Halloween film, the remake, and. She was in like a bunch of horror movies and stuff. This woman named Christina Klebe, and she kept asking me like, "Oh, I'm trying out for this when I get back. Anything I should know?" And I felt really weird about it because she was trying out for the part of Laurie, you know. And I thought she was perfect. I was like, "Oh, she'll just nail this." But so I kind of tried to help out, but what can I do, you know?
Right.
And she didn't get the part, but then you know, when I was watching the show, I was like, "Oh, she would have been really good." I hung out with her all weekend. She's a nice girl, good actress. She would have been perfect. So it's like them watching the show. And I can't help but look at the actually they cast as Laurie and she was good.
Yeah.
But part of me is like, well, too bad Christina didn't get that part. It was a weird thing that I never had with anything I've watched on TV before or a movie.
Speaking of Halloween, just a side, Halloween was just last weekend.
Yeah.
But did you happen to catch on was it Turner Classic Movies or TNT, I think it was. They were running like Halloween night, they were running all these making ofs.
Oh.
Making of Halloween,
oh, that's
making
cool.
of
oh,
Nightmare
no,
on Elm Street. They were really good. They were really interesting.
Yeah, see, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, you would have liked them. I don't know if you can catch them online or something, but yeah, there were all these making of the you know different '80s.
Well, because a friend of mine did the actually did the Halloween documentary, the 30 Years of Terror documentary.
Oh, really?
Oh. So I'd seen that. It's great. It's great. It's really interesting. But I'm sure these were different takes.
Yeah, they were like 30 minute little, you know. Short documentaries, kind of behind the scene things, but they were pretty cool.
AMC ran Halloween all, you know, it was like a Halloween marathon until they started getting into the zombie stuff. And we had it on, it's Halloween is probably my favorite Halloween movie. I'm not a big gore guy.
Horror movie or Halloween movie?
Horror, both. I guess you know I'm not into like major gore. I just love the suspense that movie builds up, and so we had the Halloween movies playing all day long. What the fuck happened with Halloween 3?
I actually know what happened there.
Oh well, then yeah, there you go.
This is an interesting story.
What was that about?
Floor is yours.
Okay, well, so John Carpenter, when he made the original film, didn't want to do a sequel. They talked him into doing the part two, but he says, this is it for...
He wrote it, but he didn't direct it.
Right. So he said, this is it for Michael. The story ends. And the studio said, well, we want to keep, you know...
The franchise.
The franchise. And he said, how about this? I'll write you a story, or I'll, you know, I'll put this together. You can keep using the title Halloween, but it'll be every movie will be like an anthology. So there'll be a series, and every year they'd come out with a new movie that was unrelated to...
To do kind of like a creep show thing.
Yeah, and exactly. Yeah. And the only way that they would be related is you'd see the movies on the TVs maybe or whatever, which in Halloween Season of the Witch, you see, you know, Michael on the TV and stuff. And that was the intent, but that movie bombed so bad.
They went in Michael Myers.
And the studio owned the things, and I think they'd kind of done Season of the Witch as sort of like, okay, John Carpenter, we'll do that.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and as soon as that tanked like shit, they're like, now Michael's back, Season of the Witch didn't ever happen, and it's the Thorn, now we're developing our own thing. Because they owned it, and they could have, they were just kind of being nice, you know, but... So they kept doing Michael movies because Michael movies sold, and you know, Killer Mask with a terrible theme song, Six More Days Till Halloween, scared the shit out of people and whatever. But to me, that's one of my favorite. I actually love that movie. I think it's brilliant.
Season
it's
of the
weird.
Witch.
Yeah, I love it.
It is really weird. I have
Tom
not seen
Atkins,
it
one
since
of my favorite actors.
It was originally on. Is probably the last time.
Oh, rewatch it. It's fantastic.
I may actually have to do that because I remember it not hating it, but just like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, yeah. It was a great idea as far as
it was
like
a factory, you know, right? It was a
the idea was that we're really going to talk about this because I can tell you, I watched this movie like 30 times.
Absolutely.
All right, so Season of the Witch is basically this company called Silver Shamrock is making these masks. There's three masks. There's a pumpkin, a witch, and a ghost. And they're making these masks, and this guy finds out that the masks, when they're activated on Halloween night, are going to basically like destroy these kids or whatever. And it's Tom Atkins, who's got the best mustache ever. Yeah. So he's trying to stop this, and... The ads for the Silver Shamrock masks, I don't know why there's some masks. There's just three masks. I don't know why they're so popular, but they're always on TV. And as it counts down, they keep getting closer to the thing, so it's like set up this tension. And you find out in the movie that they have a fragment of Stonehenge in each mask. Which
of course they do.
Yeah. And when activated at midnight on Halloween, I believe it's midnight, it turns all the kids, basically their heads, into bugs and worms. And so you get that. So
remember.
Tom Atkins is trying to stop this, and at some point has a sex scene because he's Tom Atkins. He's got to have a fucking sex scene.
That was his. Carpenter had a contract, and Tom Atkins had a contract.
No, yeah, did Carpenter write that one? Did he write?
Yeah, he wrote it or producer or something. He had something. He had a lot. I can't remember the exact, but yeah, he had something to do with it. And you know, it was his.
I'm gonna rent it again.
I recommend it. I think it's a great movie on its own. It's, you know, like. It pisses me off when someone remakes a perfect movie. Like, why remake, you know, original
Psycho.
Halloween
right,
or
right.
Psycho? You know, but that is a movie you could remake because it's not a perfect movie, but it's a great idea and has some hilarious stuff in it.
It probably would have been fine if it was just released as nothing to do with Halloween. It was just you released something called Halloween 3, and then Michael Myers isn't in it. It has nothing to do.
Where
with
is Jamie Lee Curtis?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, that's why nothing like that will ever happen again. Yeah. But at the time, it's a unique little, like, weird one-off, you know?
Speaking of Carpenter, saw that he's going to direct
Dark Child
movie. Now, I don't even know that. I mean, I know, like, that book from the covers.
I've read that comic. That's a pretty good comic.
Is it good? I've never seen it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's 90s comic, but so it's very, I don't want to say surface, but it's not like a super... It's just a
deep,
fun...
It's not a deep...
Yeah,
it's a
fun comic, and when you were 15 years old, it'd be the greatest comic ever.
Right.
Art is nice. Randy Queen is a very good artist.
Sometimes those types of comics make for better film or TV. You know, that was one of the things we were talking.
It's Weta's involved with it, so you know.
Yeah, they're doing the special effects. I saw that. Did you see
the test
art for it, or test reel for it?
Yeah.
So what's the premise of it?
It's just this girl named Ariel who kind of finds out that she's sort of this, you know,
demon
princess kind of thing. And, there's lots of demons and girls with scantily clad girls with short shorts and small boobies, but you know. But it was a fun book. I always, you know, it was a good 90s fun book.
Right.
I mean, I think it would have a tough time.
It's visceral. It's
It was very. You know, that's cool. I mean, sometimes I miss those kind of books, you know. But I think it'll make a good film. And you know, I mean, it had to. There's something to it that Carpenter must have seen in it too. So, I mean, not all his movies are great, but.
When was
all
the last
of his
time,
movies are ambitious.
When was the last time maybe I was talking about this when that news came out? And the last time I remember seeing a movie of his was Vampires, Ka-Ching.
Right.
You know, I mean, but has he made any since then? Has he directed a movie in 10, 12 years?
Yeah.
I thought he did something.
I mean, you know, the last thing of his that I really liked was his Masters of Horror thing.
I didn't watch any of those episodes.
Which is really good. But yeah, I can't. I'm sure he has. I usually try to pay attention to this, and I don't know why I'm blanking on it.
I really liked Vampires.
Yeah, that's really?
That's an all right movie.
James Woods. I took a girl on a date when I was. I think I was still. In high
did
school.
He do Ghosts of Mars after that or before that? I can't remember.
He did, I think that was.
I think that was just after. I guess I did see that too on HBO.
Yeah, that was pretty
that
bad.
Movie was.
But I mean, you know,
had an interesting premise, but that was pretty.
That came out at the same time. Now there was two of them. There was another Mars movie with Kilmer,
like
right? There was like they all came out within like 4 months of each other.
But Ghosts of Mars was like totally. I think he just kind of got distracted in the sort of remake world. You know, I mean, he did Return or Escape from L.A. And then he kind of just, it seemed like he's spent a whole lot of time doing remakes of his own films, The Fog and all that sort of stuff. He's producing those, so
yeah.
He doesn't really have to, you know. I want to see
it. He's a funny dude. When they were doing the Halloween, the making of Halloween, they kept interviewing him. And they would go to him after they would like show an interview with one of the actresses talking about, like, oh, well, this is what happened in this scene. And he's just like, yeah, that was just bullshit. I don't know.
he's
real straightforward, you know. Just
he's
like
known to be pretty jaded, actually. Like, because you know, a couple of my buddies in LA, like they do this like horror movie club thing, and you know, they'll hang out or whatever and see John Carpenter, and apparently he's like pretty jaded by the system, the Hollywood system.
Sure,
but he's a cool guy, you know.
Yeah,
like if you're just a fan, he loves you, you know. But like he kind of thinks of the studio stuff as bullshit and all this other stuff, so. Yeah, that kind of is funny. That seems totally in character.
There was one, at one point they're interviewing a critic or something, or a historian or some crap, I don't know what it was, but and he's saying, well, you know, everybody talks about Halloween being this perfect movie, but there's all sorts of mistakes in it. And then he started to point out like all these mistakes, like there's a scene where there's like a crew member's like looking over a bunch of bushes, mm-hmm. and then there's another one where I can't remember the girl's name, but it's Laurie and her friend, and they're walking, and she sees Jason in the bush.
Michael.
And then you see like smoke from John Carpenter's cigarette, like go through the you could see
but
it
that's
go
like
through the
all
frame.
Movies from 1955 to 1990.
So then they go to Carpenter, and he's like, "Shit happens."
He's like,
"I was trying to. I had 21 days to make a film.
Yeah,
it wasn't like
$5,000 budget. Yeah.
Somebody sent me something the other day too that was really interesting. Was a link. I don't remember where it was from. Otherwise, I would tell you people where to do. But it was a place where you could download all the scores that he wrote for all those movies.
Oh yeah,
and that's like one of the most effective parts about all his movies.
Yeah.
That
it's weird too because I've been checking out a lot of. At some point, I'm doing a Hack/Slash story that's based on like the Italian Giallo films, and so I've been watching a couple of those. The Dario Argento. And all those kind of things. And you realize where Carpenter comes from musically because the band Goblin, which was Argento and Claudio Simonetti, they did these bands where they and all those come from these old Giallo films. They all sound like that. Yeah. It's really weird. And you can kind of see. And then Carpenter and, you know, Romero became friends with those dudes and there's lots of collaborations. So it's weird. You can like see a little history of horror soundtracks right off that. And you can see where, I mean, you know, he's totally influenced by that stuff.
You know, and he just
flip
said
it over.
Is you know, he did the score because he was fast and cheap. You know, it's like he could get it done and he was cheap and he knew what he kind of wanted. But
all he did
it was amazing with that score for
one,
that movie.
One finger and one key.
Yeah.
You know, like that's all you gotta do. So.
Right there with the Jaws.
And Jay, let me rewind you for a second. Mm-hmm. I was gonna take it back because there's one thing I wanted to ask you guys about Walking Dead that somebody brought up to me, and I didn't catch it at first, but you know, somebody said that they didn't see this from reading the books and knowing the books, but if you had watched it with somebody else who would never know anything about it, that there are elements of the pilot that could come off a little sexist because it's really weird how the first scene in the book is it's him shooting a little girl. Then it's a scene about two guys bitching about their wives. Then the other two major zombies that get killed in the thing are both women. And they said like, you know, like if you were reading it the wrong way, I mean,
that's the weird thing about it.
I've got a point about that, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, I've even noticed this. I'm working on the Ant-Man Wasp book, and I'm just finishing it up. We were just talking about this today at the studio. So the bad guy is two, and this is completely unintentional, but it actually, if you want to interpret it, it could be. Both bad guys in the book are women, right? And both heroes are good guys, are guys. And both of those characters, Hank Pym and Eric O'Grady, have shown to have issues with women in the past.
A little bit.
So if you wanted to interpret it, it could really look like I'm fucking trying to make a statement about it. I'm not. I picked the bad guy originally was MODOK, and they said, oh, we're using him. You have to pick someone else. And the Ames Supreme Scientist was a woman. So in the book, literally in one issue, we punch Monica Rappaccini, the female head of AIM, in the face three times. So if you wanted to, it could look like I did this sort of weird
sexist thing. Well, Tim, we know that you hate women.
Yeah,
right? I hate them, yeah. Totally.
But that's the, I think in The Walking Dead, yeah. it's just like unfortunate that, you know, like the way it got cut together. And I know that that scene in the beginning with Rick and What's-His-Face talking, it's to set up the fact that he gets with his wife later on.
Exactly.
But it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, under other circumstances, you could easily, you know, like a reviewer in the New York Times would go all over it.
Well, I think it is a case of if you read the source material, it takes so long for the reveal that Shane and Lori are sleeping with each other. You can't call it an affair because they thought that Rick was dead. And
well, she's
all
trying
that
to survive. She needs somebody to protect her. It says a lot about like the situation that you're in, right?
So you have issues and issues that set that up, and it's a different pacing in comics. Where in this, I mean, for a dramatic TV show, you need to get that water boiling pretty quick. So they really needed to set up that A, Shane was kind of a horn dog, and B, that Rick and Lori
and that he kind of liked Lori, obviously. Yeah. Right off the bat, they show them the thing. He says, "Oh, stupid Lori."
Yeah. And that Rick and Lori were having issues. But you know, it was brought up to me. Did you guys, you know, maybe going back and watching that? Do you think that there was something going on with Lori and Shane before the zombie apocalypse?
Well, you have the one conversation that he has with Shane, but it didn't seem. I mean, it didn't seem that way.
Personally, that conversation for me was the weak part of the episode. Like that was the part where they shifted right
long.
From that scene. It was a little long,
and it
was kind of like
pointless.
You're losing
degree.
Me a bit.
Well,
yeah.
But you know, I mean, in that case, I think they were very concerned about setting up the sort of human element of that show, and
Shane and Rick are best friends.
Right. The comic doesn't spend a lot of time on that stuff. It's a guy wakes up and in zombie apocalypse, bum bum bum. But in the show, obviously, they're concerned about that. The Shane character kind of looks like Chris Burnham, so it creeped me out a little bit. But you know, I mean, there's things that I think they obviously did for dramatic effect for a TV show that. Actually, I can see where people are like, "Oh, it's totally sexist and whatever." But that's if you're trying to look for something. Because I know Kirkman worships the ground his wife walks on, so he never intended that, and I'm sure nobody else did. But sometimes shit looks like that. You know,
people see Jesus in like flat
potato chips.
Exactly. You can see what you want to see sometimes.
Yeah.
It was. I'm sure it wasn't intentional. If you know. It's just a series of unfortunate events.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. I think it just it's just one of those things where because of the other problems they had to fix in the show, somebody could.
But I mean,
that
what
in.
Happens when Michonne comes around? Michonne is like the badass ass chick ever, and is like, I mean, how you know? It's exactly
well, but
like,
you'd have the same people that would look at that and go, "Well, she's only you only consider her a strong female character because she acts like a man." That's the other argument. You know what I mean? It's just
people throw that shit out. But she, you know, I mean, you can see it in anything.
You can see anything.
Yeah, right.
You know.
But I mean, her situation is interesting too because she's a character who wasn't sort of like this warrior before that, and she could. So I mean, I would think a lot of people would be able to take.
Do you think whenever they get to that point that they'll actually have her ex and what her ex. Brother-in-law on a chain, muzzled.
Right. I hope so. Well,
that was one of the best introductions ever.
I don't know. It'll be. It's two seasons, right? Will they even get to that point in two seasons?
Yeah, it's going to be really weird to see how the pacing rolls out. I think by the end of the six episodes, I think everybody's going to have a better idea of what the show is going to be as opposed to the book. Right now, it's hard
spoilers.
To tell.
Are they going to kill Shane at the end of season one?
Yeah. That's the one thing that I think you come up. Well, I think that's one thing you come up against with. With a TV show versus a comic, is like Shane in the book is obviously an important character, but you get over Shane's story pretty quickly.
End of the first draft.
And I think in this, you know, you've got an actor, you signed him up, you fucking, you know, whatever.
Right.
This was going to have to.
If there's a breakout character, and we won't get into the characters that die in, say, the first 25 issues or so, but if there's a breakout character from the TV show that we know is on their way to getting killed. Yeah, Rick.
Well, they all die. I mean, it's
eventually.
But, you know, will we see a deviation and them keep a character around just because they're very popular?
I think they'll make changes. I think they're definitely going to make changes because I think if they stick too closely to the book, you may lose your core audience of people that really, you know, are, well, although I don't know what their core audience is, but I'm assuming it's, you know, the comic book fans that have
well,
not
I think,
really.
I don't
dude,
think
I mean,
so.
I don't have 8 million people watch
no,
it, so
I,
yeah, it's
I,
not
I
the
think
kind
it,
of,
I think yeah. I think it's fans of AMC. I think it's
horror,
it's zombie fans. Zombie. I think
but
it's
I think they're
going to
be driving a lot of people. I think a lot of people that are going to watch the show over the long term are going to go and find the book.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, if Image is set
yeah.
it up.
This could be
to make
our Batman 1989. I mean, this could be you know that was the first film.
I'm going to be interested to see. I mean, they had heavy promotion. It was Halloween weekend.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
It's
going
to be interested to see what the next episode and then you know the next three or four episodes, what the ratings are on those.
But I mean, with
not
AMC
to say that
too.
It wasn't good and it was, but I mean, it blew away Mad Men and every other AMC show.
8.1 million people
so
is what five something
what,
for the first episode.
What, yeah, I mean, what? Why? Is it zombies? Everybody, I guess. You
they're,
know,
I mean,
are,
it's the zeitgeist, and I mean, I think a lot of it. You know, zombies kind of always are relevant in times of like you know.
Depression.
Well, yeah, recession, depression, extreme sort of social
unrest.
Yeah, unrest, or times when you feel like you have to conform. They become popular in those times.
Right.
You know, that's why they were popular in the 60s, and now I mean it's in the zeitgeist. And I'm personally
zombies
sick
are
of
the
zombies.
New black.
Yeah, and I mean I've been sick of zombies. You know, I watch zombie movies every other day when I was a kid, and when I was a teenager and I was 19 years old, it was like you know fucking 13, 14 years ago. But, you know, I'm still interested in new stuff. But, I mean, I'm sick of it. But the public hasn't gotten sick of it yet.
Right.
No, yeah, I think it's just going to start to peak with this.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you, Kyle. You work for comic book resources. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine that it's like, okay, guys, it's Walking Dead month or Walking Dead week at least. I mean, was it kind of a scramble to say, okay, these are the Walking Dead stories that we're going to be rolling out, and you're on this, and you're on this, and you're on this? I mean, was it?
It's really
hard. How big of a deal was it for you guys at CBR?
It's really weird because you know when a show like this comes, you know you start, it's announced, and it's like, okay, we are scrambling to get anything when it's early. Can we get Kirkman on the phone? Can we get Darabont? Oh, there's no way we're going to get Darabont. Oh, Kirkman picked up his cell phone because he didn't recognize Josh's number. Oh, great, we got an interview in the can. You know, I mean, it starts like that. And then once you get to the point where the show actually debuts, AMC is calling you up and saying, hey, we've got, you know, the person that plays zombie number 12. Can you do an 8-page interview with them, please and thank you? You know, so it's a weird thing where, you know, in terms of how we serve the audience and how we kind of make a mark on what's going on, we want to be first, we want to be early. But when it comes down to that, now it's Walking Dead time, now the show is about to debut, it's almost an abundance of material. You know, we got calls with most of the producers and the cast on the phone. We got we went to New York Comic Con and we were in on kind of roundtable interviews that went on with the press. We got multiple. I mean, I think we ran a review of the pilot episode on the main page, and we have a new blog that's been around for a few months called Spinoff, which is kind of our TV media blog. We had a separate review that ran on Spinoff, and we're going to run a review of the second episode as well. So it's a weird balance, you know. I mean, usually by the time these things hit, a site like ours is. Hopefully we've already put ourselves in the loop where it's not a scramble to be like, well, what can we get? You know, hopefully we've been covering it long enough that when all this stuff kind of comes down the pike, you know, the people who make the show are primed to know that we want to talk about it, that our audience is interested in it, and then that stuff kind of works itself out. So the hardest part of covering anything like this is usually, you know, 4 to 8 months before anything debuts.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, but it's kind of like Super Bowl week in a way, and not like, you know, I'm sure San Diego Comic Con is really Super Bowl week, so this is quite the playoffs.
Yeah. All right, all right, Mr. Hype Machine.
Hey. But you know, but being happy for people, you know, I couldn't be more thrilled for Kirkman and Tony Moore and Charlie Adler. I mean, those guys have been making a great comic book for a long time, and I'm just tickled pink for them.
It's one of the funny, interesting things that when I was in San Diego, I went to the panel that was Brian Lee O'Malley's panel. Mm-hmm. With the screenwriter from the Scott Pilgrim movie. And the last thing he said in the whole panel that was very interesting to me was...
Buy a ticket, please.
We're going to bomb. I can smell it.
No, but he said that, you know, that like people kind of ask, you know, like, well, how did you get this movie made? Well, how did you turn your comic into a movie? And it wasn't his goal to make a comic into a movie. He made a comic, and the movie was sold to the studio. Edgar Wright signed up like after Volume 2 came out, and then he kept making the comic for another 5 years. You know, yeah. He made four other volumes, and that's one of the things where I think all these assholes who come out and they just want to make, I just want to sell my movie script and I can't do it, I'm going to make a comic. They're like, well, I'll make it one graphic novel and I'll put it out there, maybe it'll sell.
But you can smell that.
You can smell that. But I mean, but the reason why people like Kirkman and his guys are successful, the reason that O'Malley was successful in getting their stuff made was that it's nice that they got a movie deal, but they're comic people making first, comics. And they made this stuff over years, yeah.
But I mean, that's, and this will always be my greatest lament, is why do we go so fucking crazy because they translated something from our medium into somebody else's? I mean, you know what?
It's funny that you.
Yeah, me.
That you, of all people, say that because
I don't think a movie's that big of a deal.
Because your comic, I'm talking about Hackslash, of course, is about you translating that into comics.
Well, translating, yeah, well, I mean
that's what it is. Sure. You do it very, very well.
But I mean, it's taking a genre, which I guess technically could be anything, not a medium. It's not a medium, right? It's not a film, right? I mean, it's a genre.
Yeah, it's a genre.
So,
yeah.
But in any
slasher
case,
films.
But sure. But I mean, it always bums me out that it's like we judge things' success in comics by if they make it to another medium. Like, that's like a weird, sad, like, you know, that like you're going to graduate from high school and then go into something better. Like, what are we fucking?
Well, it's
preschool.
It goes back to the common, you know, comic book insecurity, comic book fan insecurity. Oh, they're accepting us.
Yeah.
Oh, it's okay now.
I call bullshit.
No, well, I'm just telling you what it is.
Fuck you. I want to see your shit movie make it into a comic book.
Well, but that's not reality because...
Fuck it. I don't care. I think we need to turn the paradigm.
Well, and, you know, I think that you can make just about anything into a fairly decent comic. I think it's really hard to take any comic and make it into something else.
I think it's hard to make anything a good film. I mean,
well, yeah, but that's back to John Carpenter and the studio machine.
I agree, so. But I mean, it's just weird that we consider something which is pure imagination, pure one person, two people, maybe fucking five, creative, pure energy creation, and we call that less than some 100 people trying to make something and have to go through a studio. And we call that better. It just pisses me off.
Yeah, it's just audience and coin, man. It's the amount of money spent and the amount of people watching.
Well, you know, I think it really is about focus of vision. Whenever you're talking about, you know, a comic, you're talking about one, two, maybe three people that are really focused on one thing. Whenever you're talking about a major motion picture, you're talking about hundreds of people and millions of dollars.
Yeah,
and
the people that have to
and the vision gets delayed.
Provide the sandwiches.
I think there are a few examples of comics that make it in terms of their own I think when a comic comes through and sells a shitload of copies and does well on its own, people celebrate that. But it seems like most times, you know, the tail wags the dog or whatever in that, oh, 300 made it as a big movie, then Dark Horse sells a whole bunch of 300 product. Scott Pilgrim, you know, bombs as a movie more or less, but it's been the top of the sales rankings on Amazon and everything else for months and months, you know. But, I mean, you get something like that, you know, I don't know.
Diary
of a Wimpy Kid or whatever was a phenomenon publishing-wise, millions and millions of copies. And they made a movie, and everybody was like, oh, that's nice, they're making a movie too. But the story there was that the comic hit first, you know.
That's a good point.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about.
I could use a beer.
Oh, you want a beer?
Oh, fuck. I'm giving you one of mine. Here you go.
You want a chicory stout? I need a church key for this one.
Oh, here. I got my pocket key.
Sal and I worked together, and so, you know, of course we were talking about Walking Dead after we had seen it, and one of the things that he is so good at,
you're complimenting me?
Yeah, aww. I am. You were probably just tweeting. Chris made his first hyperbolic statement at XXX.
No, I wasn't tweeting. It was not.
But I have a tendency of being, you know,
go on.
Speaking
no, no,
hyperbole.
Go back to complimenting.
But Sal is so good at compartmentalizing and judging things on what they are. It's isn't that good?
That's really good, yeah.
That is a Dogfish Head Chicory Stout.
Yeah, that's tasty.
Can I take a sippy?
Yeah, go ahead.
I ain't got
you
no
know, how about you get one of his fresh ones over there?
That's really good.
Sal is very, very good at compartmentalizing and judging things on their own merits. And I think that we as comic book fans have a tendency of, whether it's a movie, a TV show, whatever, of judging it against the source material. So You made me
as
go
you
back.
Should.
Yeah, and you made me. Well, you made me go back and rewatch Walking Dead and watch it as a TV show and nothing else. And I think that was really healthy for me to do.
Yeah, well, that's what I tried to do with sitting down watching it, is yeah. because it's like, well, I've read this book, I know what's going to happen, but I want to judge it just as purely a TV show. I don't, you know, we've talked on this show hundreds of times in the past about, you know, the fact that no matter what the show is, or no matter what a movie is made of, you know, any comic book that we love or whatever, the original source material is still there. It's never going to change. It is what it is. So no matter what The Walking Dead was going to be...
Darabont hasn't snuck into your house and rewritten the first trade.
For me, I'm
Dead.
Hoping it improves on it. It expands it. It makes it that much better. I love the comic. I hope the show makes it that much more of a cool experience for me to enjoy that world, you know? So I purely just looked at it, you know, tried to. It was hard sometimes because of the prior knowledge, but yeah, I mean, it's just... I think it's just... You can't base something, whether it's good or bad, on whether or not it meets your approval
sure.
of you and your expectations on what you had because you loved or hated.
And I never, like, that's always what's bummed me out is, like, you know, you see the Watchmen movie, which I enjoyed on its own,
itself.
Yeah,
I liked it.
But as a film, it's actually kind of weak because it sticks too close to the comic, honestly.
Yeah, it's clunky.
And there's things that, it's clunky and there's some dialogue that works great in comic books and works like shit in a film.
Enter Sin City.
Yeah, Sin City, a couple other things. Whereas, like,
which is a great case of Sin City emulating, like, noir film, and then when it gets translated to comic and then translated back to film, it's like, uh-oh.
But, I mean, all those things I enjoyed on one level or another, but I think you have to consider the medium of the whatever you make, whatever the case may be, what's the medium. And there are certainly things that I've watched in a film that I loved that make a shitty comic. Jackass would make a shitty comic. Why? Why would that make a shitty comic? Because it's about people doing things in reality, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't work. But I think literally there are people in Hollywood who wouldn't understand that. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
You could literally say, like, oh, you know what? They'd be like,
I think a Jackass comic would sell like crazy.
Right. And you'd be like, no, that doesn't make sense. These things are not the same.
It would be terrible.
Right?
It would sell great. Because
film is one medium. Uh-huh. And comic books are another.
You know what my most hated, fucking hated word ever that I hear when I go to conventions these days is transmedia. Oh, we're going to have this property. It's transmedia. It could be a video game. It could be an action figure.
Yeah, fuck you. That's what I say. Fuck you.
That means it's not good at any of them.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's... that. I'm with you on there. It drives me crazy. I mean, I think you have to... when you create something, you consider the medium that you create it in. And everything about it is the soul of that property. If that soul could transfer over to something else, you hope you get the right people to transfer it over.
Yeah.
But is the original thing. You know.
I mean, that's the whole key, though, is the right people doing it. Because
which almost never happens.
No matter what, it's all about storytelling. It's all about writing a story, telling a story. And you can do it in any medium. You can take any source material and turn it into a good story. It's just someone has to do it. Someone has to do it well.
And understand the medium that they're transferring something over to. Yeah. That's probably the most important thing that you see.
Well, the film is so different because, I mean, rarely is a screenwriter going to write. They're writing for film, but they're what's in a script and what ends up on a screen
obviously
is
different,
different.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Generally, unless it's, you know, some...
Because, I mean,
it's kind of back to that, you know, singular vision kind of thing. And that gets
which
diffused.
Film does not have. I mean, you know, it's like... But, you know, I've seen... I've had this weird thing with the Hack/Slash movie, which is where I've seen literally 7 or 8 scripts of this thing, and they just keep missing something. And I don't know why they keep asking me, like, well, what does it need? Why is it? I don't know. Why are you making shit up that isn't in the comic that you feel like maybe go to the comic? I don't know. Like, but they feel like, well, they have to sort of filmize it, but not understand the soul of the thing. Like, if you change something from one media to another, understand what it is. That's all that matters, right? Mm-hmm. And it just drives me crazy. And fortunately, and Kirkman is so fucking lucky and also so skilled in that Walking Dead understood that it's the story about people, humans living in a world of the dead. That's what it's about. That's the soul of the project. They understood that. I would hope that if, like, you know, if they made an audiobook of that property, they would understand that. If they made a serial you know, breakfast cereal out of Walking Dead, they would understand that's the soul of the project. Whatever you change, it tastes like.
You must survive your breakfast.
But I mean, whatever it is, you understand the soul of what it is.
Well,
right?
I mean, that's a big thing is survival fiction. I mean, that's a genre of its own right
sure.
now. You look at, you know, and it goes, you know, for me, you know, The Stand was survival fiction, and Survivors is not Survivor, but Survivors is survival fiction.
Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, I mean, that's what that is all about.
It's the most basic human fear. I mean, like, without the structure of society, what would happen to us?
The Colony, the reality show on Discovery, which, you know, is one of the very few reality shows. I mean, it's all about survival, and that's what they're tapping into with Walking Dead. It could be, you know, giant killer frogs out there, but, you know, it doesn't matter. It's
I don't know, in the comic, I don't remember or not, but in the show, at least the first episode,
they never say the word zombie.
They never mention the word zombie, which in one sense is kind of neat, but in the other, it took me out of the show because I'm like, what world do you people live in that you wouldn't fucking zombies?
They live in a world where there has never been a zombie movie.
But that's unrealistic because they set that world in our reality.
Well, I mean, but the thing is,
okay, you know what I mean? Everything else is our reality. It's an alternate, you know,
I mean,
I guess.
With Hackslash, we set it in a world, we had to, which is we set it in a world where all those movies are real and they've never made a slasher movie. So, and Cassie lives in the world where there is a Haddonfield, Illinois, where Michael Myers stalked. I mean, I don't say
Jason is
right. Jason and in Camp Crystal Lake was there. You said it in the world of those things, but in that world, they don't reference like, oh, I saw that movie Friday the 13th, right?
Because otherwise, you got Scream or something like that, where it's fun. Scream is a fun movie, but
I like those.
Super self-referential, and then it turns into
Zombieland.
With zombies, to me, it's such a hard thing to get away from the idea of, because I'm not just talking about, you know, George Romero, Day of the Dead. Zombies go way back before that in culture, in multiple cultures, and you know what I mean.
Really, zombies come from voodoo culture, and Romero was the first person to do this sort of epidemic. Zombie thing.
Right.
Really, they only come from voodoo culture, and that was like drug people who woke up in a coffin and they were alive, but they were whatever. That's the reality of the thing. But Romero,
I bought it, but it was a hard sell for me because it was just like, okay, nobody's seen a zombie movie in this world.
Right.
You're not. I guess it just is a little hard.
And that's what they're not. They're not zombies. They're The Walking Dead.
That's one of the things that worked about. This weekend also, I don't know if somebody at Comedy Central is just a programming genius or if it was just because it was Halloween, they re-showed Shaun of the Dead on like hours before I watched The Walking Dead. And you know, that's the thing they keep saying to Shaun of the Dead, right? Don't use the Zed word, you know? Don't do it, you know? And that's one way of dealing with that.
But like those films are commentaries upon film, which Walking Dead is not.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and you know, like, I mean, I do a comic which is essentially a commentary on film. Well, sort of. It's not a commentary on film. It's set in the world of things we've seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference. I mean, Walking Dead is a story set in basically George Romero's world.
But would it change
It's just
anything?
A different take, you know? What's that?
Would it have changed anything in the Walking Dead
I think
story?
It would have. I think the fear is gone because if you know the rules, right? Like, okay, if you're like, oh, shit, I saw this in a movie. You shoot them in the head, they die.
Yeah.
Look, Kirkman used the rules of Romero films.
Yeah, but here's my point is that it only took him to the point where he met what's his name and his son,
Dwayne, and
the other guy.
The exposition of he basically laid out the rules right there for him. So what's the difference? It's either you already know them. The only person that didn't seem to know him is Rick, because he wakes up. Out of a hospital bed.
But how much?
Everyone else already knows because they've been living in that
world.
But
how much did that add to the tension of that? You're like, dude,
and to that character.
Zombies.
I don't know. For me, it didn't. Yeah.
I think that's the thing that worked about the show as a show is that it's 24 pages, whatever, of a comic. On film, it was an hour and a half where, you know, somebody told me, like, well, I watched it, I liked it, but I thought it moved a little slow. But that's the idea. Like, you watch him absorb all of that, you know, long tracking shots in
it's
the hospital.
It's what you wouldn't get out of a movie. Because a movie would be over an hour and a half, and they'd have to resolve.
They'd have to have plot happen, and you don't. Yeah. You just get to watch it all unfold.
It's a world.
Well, you know, that was a programming thing that I was a little worried about, because I think that would be the one criticism that people would have about The Walking Dead, the first episode, is that it was a little slow. And it was very deliberate, and they built the tension. I loved that. I loved how deliberate it was.
Right.
But leading up to the premiere, they showed fucking Dawn of the Dead, which is, you know, fast zombies running around, you know, machine gun fire, the whole thing. And if you would watch that leading into The Walking Dead, that could, you know, I can see it.
But
like,
I mean,
okay,
give
audiences
reality.
A little more credit, though. I mean, it's
authentic zombies the Romero rules, the things that were successful slow for
zombie.
Years before.
It's a slow zombie world.
And why yeah. why does that work? It's the inevitability of your demise. Like, it's mm-hmm. a survival thing wouldn't work in a fast zombie world. Because, basically, like, you'd be dead. If everybody can run and chase you and fuck you up, you're done. The slow zombie thing, why it works is, and this is going back to the Matheson, I'm Legend thing, is it's the eventual and slow fact that you're going to be absorbed into this, you know.
We are.
You're all
going
to die, everybody. If you're listening to this yeah. right now, you will someday be dead.
Right, and it's all about the conformity, and, you know, it's the guy standing out in the yard and saying, Neville, you're going to join us. That's why it works. That's the thing. That's what it is. The fast zombie movies were made because movies are for people with short attention spans who go out on a night and have dinner and then go on a date and then hopefully go home and get some action. That's what movies were made for. But the reality
See,
of
Tim
the zombie-
just gets to the heart of it. He just knows what
I mean,
people
like 28 days later, that's yeah, fast that, zombies, but that wasn't done as just a
but that
bang
was a, that
zoom
was,
action
but that,
kind
that
of.
That was a sure. smart movie, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't. It doesn't
you
have
can do
to be
smart
just,
things, but that, yeah. I'm not saying you can't do smart things with fast zombies. Yeah. But I'm saying
and they
that,
weren't zombies.
But
they
my
were the
my
infected.
Point, is, I had no problem with the pace of The Walking Dead. To me, I just thought that they didn't use it as well as they could have. I thought. It wasn't written well enough to have that slow of a pace, to me.
Okay.
I think, like this, we were talking about with Shane and Rick earlier, that the dialogue in that scene fell a little flat. It felt a little...
See, I actually liked it. I
really?
To me, it sounded like some Southern dudes talking about some shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that, but if you're going to have that scene, why not use it to accomplish something more than just setting up the fact that these guys are buddies? You know, you could do that really quickly and easily, and people would get it. They didn't do it in a way like that. Didn't you could have done that entire thing as effectively in a third of the time? Is all I'm saying.
You could have done it in the chase scene to the. You
I
know,
mean, you,
well,
they actually did yeah. do it. I mean, when Rick shot. You feel that actor, you know, you feel Shane's, you know, fondness sure. for Shane, for Rick in that moment. So that's what I mean.
But
they could have done something
up.
Better with that is all I'm saying.
Well, I think what the attempt of all that stuff to set up yeah. was the humanity and reality of life before survival, which yeah. is in the world before everything goes to shit, you're doing everything you can to survive. There's moments of like
yeah, it's the setup.
Fucking around
I mean,
levity. I can sure, eat some sure. fast food and sit around and bullshit. This is the world that you and I live in. Like, no matter what we say, it's a pretty much bullshit easy existence. You know, it's yeah. like sometimes you got to worry about getting a job, but pretty much you can sit around and fart and fucking shit and just absorb your life. And then suddenly, without those things, what is survival all about? Mm-hmm. I mean, it really did sort of work in that way. It's like, here's your sort of vapid existence, talking about nothing, your reality TV and your whatever. Right. And here is your switch to a world where...
And the one moment yeah. that really did work for me in that scene between Rick and Shane was at the very end, when Rick comes to the point he's trying to make, was that I don't want my wife saying this about our relationship, whatever, in front of the kid, you know?
Sure.
Like, it seems it was like, you know, 7 minutes, however long the conversation was, of bullshit
oh, yeah.
to one real moment.
To one
you know?
Real, yeah. And a real moment that is going to play out, obviously, in that story, which yeah. you and I, we all know, which is that Lori is going to take less of an important part in that story in about 50 issues.
Spoilers!
There was one other part that bugged me, because throughout it, you kept hearing his son's name was Carl.
Yeah.
You know, and they set that up. You never saw Carl until the end, but he kept setting it up that Lori and Carl are in Carl. And then when they finally revealed Lori and Carl, they had this perfect opportunity when she's in the tent and the kid runs in and says something, and then he goes back out. And she could have just gone, Carl, blah, blah, blah. And she doesn't. They go back to Rick and he pulls the picture down and looks at him like, what the fuck is that? Why did they bother to do that?
Yeah, you just
you had
have
this
to
perfect opportunity
Carl.
For her
yeah.
to go
yeah.
Carl, but and then everybody goes, "Oh, that's Lori and Carl."
I was really, I mean, and you guys said it earlier. You know, the idea that they need to set certain things up earlier because of how the TV show works. But we have lost that moment in the comic when he shows up and he finds them, and then he's like, "Oh wait, you're fucking my wife now." When Rick learns it in the comic, you learn it as the audience, and we've lost that moment. And I understand yeah. that there's reasons to tell
no,
us
no, that's
that earlier,
true.
But. But the way they told us earlier wasn't done as well as they could have done it.
That's my whole point is I thought I really liked the show. I really thought it was they did a great job with it. I'm going to watch every fucking episode that comes out, sure. believe me. I just thought I was nitpicking it because it was done so well, and there was just moments where I thought it could have been done that much better. That's all. That's all. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, but I certainly didn't dislike it. I there was just things I was just like, ooh.
Well, the night before, when I got home, I had to drive back from the Detroit Fan Fair, so I only got to cut like the last 10 minutes of the show. And when I saw it out of context and watched like the last 10 minutes of this TV show, and I was like, "This is not good."
But, right.
It was that Wang Chung song, right?
Right. It just seemed really confusing, and I didn't, you know. But whatever. So then two nights later, I sit down and watch it with my wife, and I really, obviously, everything before that really made it work. And I'm watching my wife watch it, and just seeing her
the build up.
Yeah,
and the buildup is there, and that's what I told Chris, is that 20 minutes in, I was sort of bored.
Yeah,
40
yeah.
minutes in, I was like all about looking around my fucking, you know, looking around in the corners of my room for a zombie.
And so I'm watching my wife watch it, and just seeing her intense reaction to the story. And I mean, my wife watches a lot of TV. I haven't seen her react to something like that. I mean, she reacts to that when she watched like the Doctor Who final episode of the season with it. Like she that you know was what awesome. I mean? Which was awesome. So to me, if that first episode reached that level of her being that into it, you know, and
when he's going down the dark staircase and lighting the matches to find his way out of it, that's when I was like, okay, they caught the tension.
Yeah,
and I know that he's going to get out.
But the reality of that sort of thing.
Just another nitpicky part for me. I'm like, why don't you just light a fucking torch on fire, dude?
Yeah.
You're surrounded by crap and you're lighting little matches. And
but I mean, he's...
Who doesn't fucking know a match is going to burn in like 5 seconds?
But there was a cool thing about that because you saw him, he's completely fucked up. He's dehydrated. He's exhausted. His muscles are atrophied. Like, man, I've watched myself do some shit where I look at it later and be like, you would have been much better at that if you were fucking awake. You know what I mean? And this is a guy who's messed up and was so well portrayed. Like, he gets up. My favorite scene in that episode is he's walking around. He doesn't know what's going on. He goes up to that door and it says, don't open, dead inside. And there's hands popping out. He has no idea what's going on. There's humans there, but he knows they're not good, right?
Right.
And he doesn't know there's zombies and all that shit. And he's just so confused. He's like, okay, I know I'm not supposed to open that. That was creepy.
Yeah.
It's creepy.
Oh, yeah.
He wants to talk to someone, but he knows not to talk to these assholes. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't know the situation, but...
It's like whatever's behind effective. That door is not a good thing.
Right. So. It was very
effective. And how about the British actors that are sprinkled all over this thing?
Well, British actors are sprinkled on everything on TV, by the way. If everything you watch is either British or Australian, except for Joel McHale. No, they're just... I've actually tried to figure this out, and there's an exotic look to these people that it's exotic white people. Which is it really is.
Whenever you put people on an island for several thousand years, they become exotic.
Is that what we're saying?
Which is they don't look American, but Americans have a sort of weird colonial thing where they sort of it really is that thing. Why is House work for people? Though Hugh Laurie plays
of Sherlock
American,
Holmes.
Right? I mean, yeah, well, that's true. With his Watson and Wilson, but what makes that character work is he's a certain amount of foreign that makes him universal, right?
Okay.
They become so like they become, and there's got to be a reason why we hire Australians and fucking British to play American in every TV show you watch.
Because they're square jawed and they're very. They're the American ideal, even though they're not American. They've got elocution. Yes. Yeah. Well, that's and then there's that. They're not. They look like an American football player, but they can talk.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, you know, you see that sort of thing though all over the world. Like, if you watch some Japanese movies, like I watched this Godzilla film where they have this American actor. He's a big black guy playing their TV reporter, right? And are you good?
No, I'm gonna go get some out of here.
But they, like, I was watching this, and they put this American actor who's a big black guy on TV on a Japanese film playing their news reporter, and he's like, there's something about him on film which instantly makes it interesting and compelling, right?
Right.
Because in Japan, everybody's sort of shorter and in a different color.
Japanese.
So you've got this big black guy and this Japanese movie going, Godzilla's taking ashore. He's not even a good actor, right? No. But it's like, Godzilla's attacking, we need to destroy him. And it's like that, people respond to that in a film. And you know, so you see that with these sort of the Brits and the Australian actors, we love them. We just, we love them. As much as America is so xenophobic, we love them on film. It's kind of weird.
And that's one of the reasons, too, why, and this is, I'll change the topic for a second, but, you know, it's like, I, if you guys have seen the photos from the Captain America movie that are gonna, that have been hitting online, and I don't know what you're pointing to.
Quit confusing them.
You're confusing me while I'm talking on the mic. No, but so like one of the things that's really interesting is that they've changed the makeup of how they're doing Captain America a little bit. It seems. I mean, I have no, I speak with no knowledge. But the Red Skull is not a Nazi. He's not wearing a Nazi uniform with a red armband. He's a member of Hydra, which they may say at some point is some kind of specific scientific unit of the German army. But why would they do that? Why would they make it like Indiana Jones, where he's going to punch a bunch of Nazis in the face? Oh, because they want to sell this movie in Europe, you know? Yeah. And they can't make a movie
well, there's that classic.
And sell in Germany. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you heard about this, but when you see watch Iron Man on demand, I can't remember what station it is, they actually removed all references to Russia.
Really?
And yeah, and they removed all that sort of stuff because that, you know, that's like your international flight movie. I don't, if you watch in America, whatever, but it, your international flight movie where they're going to play this, you know, PG-13 right. on the international flight, they're going to remove all references to damn and hell and shit and Russia and God and whatever and anything that could be offensive to any stupid overly sensitive fuckle anywhere.
Yeah.
And
well, legally, I mean, you can't like you can't sell anything in Germany with the swastika on it or promote it. You know,
I so, wouldn't I
mean,
think Germany would be a big enough market to be give a shit.
A lot of Germans.
I don't
out
know.
There.
I don't
a lot
know.
Of Germans. Where else I saw that?
I can't. I mean, it's a movie called Captain America. Is it really going to go over well in Europe anyway? It's called Captain America. I don't know.
People love Obama. I mean, right now is the time to sell that movie.
It's a time of change and hope, Sal. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a World War II movie, so if you're going to do World War II,
it's
going to
be Nazis.
You know, where else I saw this was the Avengers, the Mightiest Avengers, the Earth's Mightiest Heroes cartoon.
The cartoon, yeah.
Came out on Disney XD or whatever they call it, and the Captain America episode was a flashback to World War II, and it had like World War II real footage and that kind of stuff. But instead of the swastika, it was the Hydra symbol, and it was talking about how Hydra was, you know, overtaking Europe.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that because I mean I think
it's comic books. That's fine.
Well, no, I think also at this point it's like, you know, we're all intelligent enough to realize that yeah, not every Nazi was Hitler. You know what I mean? A lot of German soldiers were just soldiers. They were just doing what they were
told.
They're
farmers.
They didn't want to get shot. You know what I mean? It's like,
sure.
So it's like, do we just keep demonizing
Germans? But Hydra agents, assholes.
Hydra agents, they join up because it's an evil organization. That's all right.
Oh, and good benefits too.
Sure. But I can tell you this weird thing that when I worked at Devil's Due, we did G.I. Joe Transformers. And at the same time, Dreamwave was doing their version, which they sent in World War II. And Hasbro, which is owned by the Hassenfeld brothers, who are Jewish, had no interest whatsoever in sending anything that involved the Nazi symbol. So they told them they could never show Nazis, even though it's set in World War II, so it became Cobra, whatever. I have a feeling that the Disney Marvel thing cartoon, they don't want some parents to be clicking by on cartoons and go,
ooh,
click,
swastika.
Click, swastika.
What the fuck?
Worst thing. That's what they don't want. It's that one, that like knee-jerk reaction from some fucking nut job somewhere.
In the Ozarks or whatever.
In the Ozarks, whatever. I mean, people are typically liberal. They probably are Nazis, but whatever the case may be,
they're going to write up and be there wasn't enough Nazis in this thing.
I was just listening to a podcast with Mel Brooks. He was talking about the producers.
Mm-hmm.
And originally the title of the film was
Springtime for Hitler.
And, you know, he changed it because he had a lot of theater owners who were Jewish, and they're like, yeah, we're not going to fucking put Springtime for Hitler on the marquee. We're not giving him any billing. You know, it's just...
Do I look Italian?
So that's why he changed. So it's just a matter of like, yeah, you know what? I'm not... In good or bad, it doesn't matter. Just it's better to maybe just like...
I mean, I totally understand that. But like the joke I just made that probably didn't come as a joke, which was they're not liberals, they're Nazis. That probably came off like I was being crazy. Is that people... But what I mean is that people respond to the first thing you see, right? They respond to that sort of like first. If you have, like when I was in college, we did a my final project was The Power of Symbols. That was my senior college project. And we had all these different symbols, like 30 of them, you know, stop sign, all these different things. One of them was the symbol of the swastika. It was on a poster. It was posted throughout my college campus for our show. And, you know, guess what? I had to sit down and have a meeting with the Jewish Students League because I put a Nazi symbol on a poster that I distributed throughout a college campus. Now, did I prove
my
point?
Way to go, Tim.
Yeah. Well, because anytime you see
that
symbol,
did I prove my point about the power of symbols?
Right.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I had a similar thing when I was in high school.
Was I an insensitive asshole? Yeah, in a weird way, I came across as just now I'm pushing their symbol. I'm not. I'm talking about symbols as...
Well, know, that's the thing.
It's easy to think where I was in high school and it was an art class and the assignment was, you know, do a portrait of somebody famous. Who, you know, the idea was how well can you recreate somebody whose look is iconic? And one guy did David Letterman and somebody did the president, whatever. And then somebody drew a picture of Hitler. You know, I mean, you know, that mustache and that the thinning hair, whatever. It's iconic. You know, people know what they look like. And when everybody did their assignment and they put them up in the school library and then people went apeshit. Why is there a picture of Hitler in the library?
Right.
And they're not thinking of it in the same way. You
know? It's yeah. And it's hard.
Well,
it's
you know, on the symbol, it's one of my favorite George Carlin quotes. He's like, "I don't believe in symbols. I leave symbols to the symbol minded."
That's sure.
One of my favorite
but,
quotes.
I mean, but do I understand like when a Jewish student was walking across campus and came across my poster for my show, which had like a heart and a fucking the circle with the slash through it, meaning this is no whatever, and then a Nazi symbol? Did they think my show was? I get it. I do. I don't know how to rectify how that works.
I don't know either. I mean, at some point, it's like, you know, are some things just left, you know, alone completely? Do you almost just sort of like, you know, not ignore, but like do not acknowledge in any way? Because
well, I think you can't ignore what things have meant. I think you can't do that. Yeah. But if there's a way to like get across to people that's not what I meant.
Well,
I
the
mean,
problem is anytime you show
it,
it's the immediate reaction is you're supporting it.
Yeah,
or in support. You know what I mean? That's true. The problem. Is that?
Well, that's what symbols are for. Is to you show a symbol, and it's an immediate,
right?
It's immediate understanding that I stand for this.
This idea.
Right. Even if you are using the symbol to. I mean, it doesn't matter what you use the symbol for.
Right.
Yeah.
They know that. Hey, they know what that symbol is supposed to mean.
If I was walking around with a jacket that had an AT&T logo, people were going to think that I either work for or really like AT&T. You know,
I mean, that's part of this weird sort of human thing that I don't think you can avoid it. I wish we were sort of more.
That's why
Superman's S and the Flash.
Jesus, you, Mr. What? Fanboy Scout. Or no, I'm sorry. Yes. It's not. It's
hey,
it's
don't
the,
get me in trouble. The Fanboy Legion.
Fanboy Legion. It's a recognizable mark that associates you with a group.
Well, yeah,
culture.
But it's not necessarily. I mean, like in Tim's case, he wasn't promoting the Nazi Party.
Yeah,
he was. It was a project. But like you said, it's how do you balance it? How do you know? It's like okay, is it so offensive to just for that? You know, my wife's great grandmother was, you know, in an internment camp in Nazi Germany. You know, she was Jewish and she has the tattoo. And yeah, that's something for her to even see that symbol, I'm sure would be a horrible, horrible experience. She's gone now. But is it the same for, you know, a kid that's never even?
But I mean,
you know,
it's like it's so hard to choose things that are part of our collective consciousness. They're part of all of us. As far as we relate to things versus you actually experience this, like it's tough.
I think
you can do like Venture Brothers and have Girl Hitler and no one's offended, right?
Right.
Or the latest Taskmaster, which had a village full of Hitlers, or no one gets offended by that sort of thing. But if you throw that sort of symbols, they can be translated as. Even if you're criticizing, can be translated as support.
Yeah,
I think that's
well,
the tough
I think
thing.
That's the thing. There's two things that run to mind. One is if nobody's ever read the Johnny Ryan story from Angry Youth Comics about Hitler, you know, where Hitler hires a PR guy to make him seem more hip to the youth or whatever.
Johnny Ryan, is he the guy that did Prison Pit?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's insane.
He's insane.
Awesomely insane.
Hitler, it was a great issue of Angry Youth Comics. But the more point was making is that. You can place that stuff within
it's
context.
That's one of Vince B's favorite creators. I'll just let you know.
If you go to an art show and at the front of the art show they say, hey, there is some imagery or some symbolism in this that can be construed as, it's like when you get an email that says not safe for work. You know going in there must be something there. But when you're trying to promote that show and you're doing it without context, within a flyer.
Context is everything.
Context is everything. Yeah, and that's absolutely. Like that great issue of Ex Machina that Brian K. Vaughan and Tony Harris did about the Abraham Lincoln with the with the Hitler imagery or whatever, you know, and is, you know, talks about that a lot too. But that's the thing. It all depends on how you place it and what people know about what they're about to see going into it.
Symbology, it is very powerful.
I mean, because I've also done shit for, I did Loaded Bible, which has, you know, a Jesus vampire thing.
But and Jesus was the hero.
He was the hero.
And he was versus the vampires.
But I get shit for that sometimes.
Why are vampires always evil?
Where sometimes people don't understand my point. If you actually read the book, it's sort of about...
If you
about,
had, like, Jesus versus Twilight, you would have been in the shit.
I would have been the shit. But the point of the book is about separation of church and state. That's what it's about. That's the whole point of the book.
I've heard that is not in the Constitution.
Well, if you actually look, going back, if you kinda, go back and read it.
Kind of going towards comics a little bit, I remember reading in Scott McCloud, one of Scott McCloud's books on creating comics. I don't remember which one. Making Comics.
Understanding,
or,
reading.
Yeah, making, having sex with comics. there was something I remember him pointing out about his theories or his thoughts on why we... sort of as a society are so attracted to comic book characters,
sure.
That kind of thing.
Universal relatability of the symbol.
And the symbol, but also because we are able to project ourselves on them. Because
the more general.
The more general, the more generic something is,
the more you can put yourself
in it. So a symbol, you know, that's the same sort of thing. It's like you see, you know, going all the way back to the beginning of our conversation of what, when you see, you know, in The Walking Dead, whether you see it sexist or not, it's kind of, you know, what you're projecting on. You can kind of see whatever you want to see in it. So.
I mean, certainly there have been things made that are clearly just sexist or clearly just racist or clearly just hateful. But I think a lot of things you can put your own experience on to good or bad effect. I mean, why does Mickey Mouse work so well? You know, Mickey Mouse has got black spots and white spots and whatever. He's not a person. He's universally relatable because... You know, Steamboat Willie is fucking chugging along on his job, and he kind of looks like whatever. He looks like all of us.
You can project whatever you want.
Or Hello Kitty, who has three facial features, which is two eyes and a nose and whatever.
Smiley face.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
You know, four. No, I'm just,
But I mean, smiley face, we reduce everything to these sort of things, and then we relate to that, and then we expect it to carry on the message that we'd like to carry.
Right.
Even though
that's when we get in trouble.
That's when we get in trouble. Wow, we may have just discovered something right there.
I think we did.
We relate to things universally, but then we get in trouble when we expect them to carry on our specific message. That's very interesting, actually.
How poignant. We've come up with something poignant, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean,
by mistake.
Which is a weird thing about comics is that our job is to universalize in cartoon. And but in the end, I you know, we're also sort of going for a specific sort of thing. I think sometimes we lose things along the way.
Well, back to your point, and what we were talking about earlier too, is that I think when we run into problems of I want that movie based on the comic book that I love to go in a certain direction because I'm projecting myself on that book, on those characters, and then when the movie or TV show goes in a different direction, I'm not really happy about it because it's really me. That's you know what I mean.
You.
It's not a comic book anymore. It never was. It's always been me from the beginning.
Yeah, it's
you
tough.
Know, Superman Returns sucks because not because it was badly written or anything else, but because I'm Superman, not the douchebag that played Superman. I want Christopher Reeve because that's who I see myself as, not whatever that guy's name, you know,
Brandon Ralph.
Who was awesome as Superman.
Oh, yeah. But you know what I'm saying? I'm speaking in generalities. You know, I'm just saying.
You're really angry about this movie.
I never knocked up some girl I worked with. What the fuck, you guys?
But, you know, just sort of.
Well, I mean, the more universal the story, the more appeal. And you can make things that appeal to specific audiences and still be successful. But the widest appeal, Superman, strange visitor from a strange land, trying to do good, even though he's not relating to these people, is all of us.
Yeah.
X-Men, you know, people who are chastised and cursed for who they are, despite trying to do the greater good, we all relate to that. All of us believe our politics are right, our race is right, whatever the case may be, even though we're all thinking the same thing, makes those things accessible.
Cause I made my mind up, you're going to be mine. I tell you right now, any trick in the book now, baby, all I can find.
Everybody enough. Is hustling. I met him. I was at the. This is before I left New York. I was at the Marvel Christmas party, where Hader and what's his face, the head writer, the guy who does the news, showed up for the first time because it was at a comic book club. Those guys who do the videos for Newsroom and do the comic book club.
Alex Albin and all those guys.
Yeah. And they brought them to the party or whatever. And it was weird because it was like Brubaker and then Bill Hader and then what's-his-face and then somebody else. And they all got drunk. And that's why they did that Spider-Man one shot, was because they just got invited to the Marvel Christmas party. And everybody at Marvel was like, please do something. Please give us something to do. Whatever.
But only if Kevin Maguire draws it.
I think he actually declared that, yeah. Oh, you know?
Yeah, it works for me.
Short Halloween.
Yeah. But they're nice guys. They're really cool.
Cool. You know, we had mentioned, or I had mentioned a little bit earlier, the Avengers. Avengers, the Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And I'm watching this thing, and I came to this realization that I'm liking this cartoon more than the comic book.
No. But I mean, it's the original team.
Yeah,
it's the original
and
Avengers.
And that's not a declaration that all Avengers comics are not very good. And
is this where you go on a Bendis rant?
No, it's not where I go on a Bendis rant. It's where I go on a, you know, sometimes you just need to boil things down and make them fun and fresh. And whenever you make a cartoon of something and it's thrown out there for a brand new, totally new audience, and you just boil it down to what it is, it's really fun and entertaining, and it doesn't have to be mature, and it doesn't have to be, you know, what we have come to expect out of comics. And I'm just like, well, but they still make that comic. It's called Marvel Adventures Avengers. Why don't I read that? Because the comic book and
it's
the
not as easy to digest.
Because the cartoon is awesome. I love it. I'm going to go home and watch some tonight.
Avengers is the comic I've read longest my whole life. Read Avengers longer than I've read any other comic. Savage Dragon is second, I think. I've got 15 years on Savage Dragon. I've got like 25 on Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. The original idea is always best. Mm-hmm. The original concept, there was original mix. It was completely random and accidental. It is the best. And it will always be that way.
Really, really good superheroes getting together to fight against the threats mix, that they couldn't take on by themselves.
And the mix, I think, was always the best because, the Hulk as an Avenger is brilliant. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to ever tackle that again. But the fact that they had to like rein in this dude who was like the fucking loose cannon, and then you had Hank and Jan who were sort of this dysfunctional couple, and Cap is this like, you know, weird leader,
man out of time,
and Iron Man. And
and sometimes when you take those original ideas and you put them in the hands of somebody that hasn't been working with them for 20 years or 10 years, you know, and it's the first time they...
Yost writes really good comics. He writes fucking awesome cartoons.
Yeah. You know, sometimes it just works even better. I mean, I haven't watched all of those episodes yet, but like I saw the mini episode of the Ant-Man one, and it was the first time in any comic...
cool.
Yeah, that I was like, wow, Ant-Man can be really cool.
So my job is to tap this cartoon.
Yeah.
I have Ant-Man coming out next week, fucker. Yes.
And Ant-Man will be again very soon.
I have not read your Ant-Man, right here. So... just the way... And it was only a little short.
Sure.
But it was just the way that they presented him of like, oh, you know what? Shrinking...
It's
can
cool.
be really cool, and a little dude with like the proportionate strength of a full size human being it's jumping cool. around
can be a badass.
Could be really cool if you show it right. If you show
I mean,
that
I think that was the approach. So when my editor called me and said, "Hey, what would you do with Ant-Man and Wasp?" And the first thing that comes to your mind is like, "Oh, comic fans make fun of those guys all the time," and you get kind of bummed out. And the second thing that comes to your mind is like, man, Kirby kicked the fuck out of this.
Yeah.
You know, like, so you go, I went back to, and I read the original, The Man in the Ant Hill, and I read all the original
all the Tales of Astonish
and all this sort of stuff. It's like, this wasn't lame then at all. And whoever thought that this was lame.
I'm sorry, but Kyle.
Kyle cracked out the high life.
He's living the high life.
He's turning. I think he's turning into Tom.
I know.
He's kind of morphing into.
It's like a Tom appreciation.
It's an homage. It's an homage to Tom.
Tom Caters, who is a long time co-host of the show, was a hard hat beer guy.
This is whenever I go. I'll let Tim get back to your story in a moment. Whenever I go and play, my buddies are in a band, and I sing with them sometimes, and they have a place they rent downtown. And every time I go there, it's like 40 Dirty 30s of High Life that just sit stacked in a corner for them to drink. So I've grown to appreciate the subtle bouquet of High Life.
Cheers to you. That's my dad's favorite beer. My dad came to,
that's my dad.
My dad came to Chicago, and I took him out to this fancy bar, Owen and Engine, down in Western there. And he ordered a beer, and he said, "I want Miller High Life." And they said, "What? No, we don't have Miller High Life." And then he said, "Well, what tastes like Miller High Life?" And then I felt like a fucking asshole. But I dragged my dad to a bar that sold like $15 fucking cans of beer, and they were amazing. My dad really wanted an MGD. Felt like a fucking asshole.
That's awesome.
I felt like an asshole.
I'm sorry.
So back to continue with
story. So one of these things that there's this sort of generation of cynicism that came after those original ideas, which is, you know, Aquaman talks to fish and that's fucking lame, and Ant-Man shrinks down and that's fucking lame. Here's the thing. You know what? Ant-Man was way cool before Wolverine was ever fucking cool. Oh, yeah. And here's the, you know, and if you don't approach it with that sort of same interest in almost like a naivete where you're like, no, that's an awesome idea. And so hopefully, like,
if you don't take the character seriously, nobody else is going
to. Yeah, and I think that's a problem, is that people started to give into these sort of like older jaded fan visions of what the character should be. But when I was a kid, the notion of shrinking or growing was fucking cool as shit.
Oh yeah.
And as you get older, you like start to go, "Oh, it's fucking gay. Popping claws and being able to regenerate is way cooler."
Right.
You're like, "No, fuck you, man. These are all awesome ideas. It's just the way you play it, you know?" So like I hope, and I appreciate that they made that shit cool. I haven't seen the cartoon. I'm going to love it. I know. Yeah. Avengers, really, literally, longest comic I've followed. Savage Dragon is the only thing that comes close. But the idea that they made that shit cool, amazing. I hope we do it. We have a scene in issue 2 of Ant-Man where he gets small and runs up. He's got sort of suppression on his boots. He's able to run up your body and then punch you in the head. Like, I think that's a cool scene. Like, you see a little guy, like, you're like, "Oh, he's running up my body." You try to swat him off, and he just punches you in the face. That's fucking cool. He's got the strength of, like, a dude of his size. It bums me out that some of those greatest characters are sort of treated as jokes. I mean, Ant-Man and Wasp were the original Avengers.
Five.
When I was a kid, my dad brought me... The first comics I ever saw of Avengers was because my dad brought me his old comics.
And a High Life.
I thought those things were fucking cool. They were like, yeah, and a High Life. Yeah. Enjoy this MGD and Avengers number 4. But, you know, and he didn't make fun of him. He just said, here's the comics I really liked, and I grabbed on, and why?
Well, I mean that stuff just spun right out of the weird science and all of the comics, the science fiction comics of the 50s. Here we are in the early 60s.
The Incredible Shrinking Man and all this sort of like ideas. Yeah,
he's a super intelligent scientist that can control his size and shrink small. Or,
and it's just
or grow.
So weird that
it's a
like,
basic wish fulfillment thing. Yeah,
sure. But Hank is defined by a sort of shitty issue where he punched his wife in the face. Like, that is what defines that character. And unfortunately, that character was cool when Kirby made him up. And, Kirby and Stanley made him up. And it bums me out that a character is defined by, like, the worst moment that someone wrote for him.
Who wrote that, anyway?
Jim Shooter.
It was
Jim Shooter did some great issues of Avengers, but I think he got desperate and tried to make Hank into something that he could play off of as the, like, sort of bad boy.
Right.
And it just came across as really sort of stupid. And
Jim Shooter did some really amazingly good stuff, and then some really, like, didn't Jim Shooter also write the Hulk almost gets raped by 2 men at the YMCA issue or whatever?
Sure.
You know, and it's like, okay, sometimes you just need to forget the bad stories.
Sometimes
you get the feeling that Shooter was watching the TV movie of the week a little
that he was
too
trying
much.
To, yeah. And I think the problem with If Kirby had seen what would become of Hank, he would have been pissed off.
He'd have beat somebody's ass.
Yeah, and so In my case where I'm like, here, you're tasked to write these classic characters, this classic fucking character who's been around as long as Thor or fucking Iron Man, but who's never had the respect. How do you treat this? And you go, okay, here's the shitty story he was involved in, and here's all these other great ones. You have to acknowledge the shitty sort of like, this character is a fucking asshole story, but why rely on
that? Why is that the only
thing? Why is that the only thing that we remember? I mean, this character is great. It's like he's a brilliant scientist. He's like an atheist who is so smart he can't believe in God. It's like there's so many great ideas there.
Dan Slott actually did a lot to.
I liked Dan's stuff. He also sort of made him more depraved than I would ever have done. And so when I read Dan's stuff and they said, okay, here's what we're kind of doing with him, and he had him like, you know, sort of in a weird relationship with Joe Casta to replace his relationship with Jan. That shit I never would have done in a million years. So when I took it on, it's like, I'm going to make this character more pure. I like characters who are faulted, but I don't want them to be fucked up. I don't want them to be perverts. They're superheroes. Mm-hmm. They're pretty good, right?
Well, how do you handle Eric O'Grady?
No, he's a fuck up.
Okay.
But he's a fuck up.
He's a foil, though.
He's
right?
A fuck up. He plays off the other. He's a fuck up. He's not fucked up.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the way that you have to handle Eric O'Grady, and the way that I really like what Kirkman treat him as, is that he would really like to be a better person, but he isn't. And mm-hmm. that's a really interesting character in that he actually strives for better, but he just doesn't
he can't get out of his own
that's
way.
Really cool. Yeah. I mean, like, his aspirations are better than most characters in the Marvel Universe, whereas he's like, you know, he's like sort of a tweak on the sort of Spider-Man. Your greatest responsibility, you know, great power breeds greatest responsibility, is greatest responsibility keeps causing me to do worse shit.
Yeah.
And he means well, but he's that sort of like great character.
Well, he's what Spider-Man would have been if the spider had bitten Flash Thompson and not Peter Parker.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an appealing character in the way that it's so Marvel. You know, like Marvel was always about these sort of faulty characters who did their best to be better. You know, Hawkeye or Spider-Man or, you know, it comes down to that sort of thing, which DC was always like, you know, their characters were always the purest examples of human.
Marvel's characters had clay feet. Their heroes
had clay feet, but they were always trying to be better.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think we've lost that in a lot of things, but those characters... You know, exactly.
It went from that, and you know, not to necessarily rip on Wolverine or anything, but to that, it changed to the more of an anti-hero. Yeah. From a flawed hero to an anti-hero.
I've never liked the Punisher very much. And, you know, like some other characters where it's like, I would rather see what they try to do to be better than what they did to be a fuckhead.
Well, I mean, staying with the Avengers, you know, Avengers number 16, they totally get rid of the original team and they bring in
Kooky Quartet.
Yeah, a convict and two members of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and Captain America are the new Avengers.
What made Marvel to me as a kid so appealing, and I hope it is always eternally renewing, which is, you have these great powers and you're going to redeem yourself, right? Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver, Hawkeye. All these characters are... That's what I think makes the Avengers so great, right? That's what makes them not the Justice League. And, you know, and you hope that people constantly sort of renew that thing. But they should always try to be better people.
But how how do you take a character like Hank who, like you said, his worst moment is years and years behind him, though. Like, at this point, how is Hank flawed?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Well, like, how do you set up a flaw for him? How do you set up a weakness for him to try and overcome, without going back to the same tropes?
That's easy. He's one of the smartest people on the planet, but he's never going to be as smart as Reed Richards or Tony Stark.
Yeah, but that's a character flaw, not necessarily a flaw. But the way we played him in the book is
if you are so smart, like if you're Hank and you're so smart, everyone else is you're basically impatient with them. You're really trying hard to like. But you have so many ideas. Like, Hank's problem is he has so many ideas, he's so focused all the time that he misses things like simple things like shaving and taking a shower and being courteous. All these things are secondary to him because, really, if you're at the bank teller and you're like, you know, I'd like to get out 20 $1 bills, and they're taking their fucking time, and the only thing you can think is of, I could have solved world hunger in the time it took me to get those things.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, how would that not make you an impatient?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the toughest thing for Hank is he's a stranger in a strange land, is everyone else moves at quarter the speed of what he does. So in his case, it's like being the... he comes across as being sort of an immoral jerk, which in fact is he's just ahead of the game. And Eric O'Grady comes across as being an immoral jerk because he is an immoral jerk.
But he's really trying.
But he's trying so hard, which Hank has never had to try. Right. And I think that's where the characters kind of meet in the middle, and that's what I had to find to do this series. And it thrills me to think that when they do the cartoon, they're going to pick up on those very subtle things that made those Stanley and Jack Kirby characters so relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe those kids reading the books the first time didn't catch it right away, but you read The Man in the Anthill, the first appearance of Dr. Pym, and that is already apparent to that character. He's overconfident. He's so full of himself. He's egotistical, but he's really trying to help. But he's kind of moved beyond that by the time.
It's funny how, you know, as much as we look at modern comics and you know, how we like to think how much more mature or complex they are, the simpler ways that, you know, they were able to get across those ideas, those concept of characters. I mean, Peter Parker was very easy. You know, I mean, you understood that character right away.
I think it's not necessarily complexity, is that they nailed it up right off the bat. And it got more complex because the sort of the level of what you had to translate into other media and all these sort of things. But it was all there in those first stories. Mm-hmm. That's why Daredevil and all those original Stan and Jack or Stan Lightwood or Stan and Steve Ditko stories are still around, is because right off the bat, they captured everything you needed to know. Justice is blind, boom, Daredevil. Great power, responsibility, boom, Spider-Man right off the bat.
But that's what I mean. They just took really simple, actually simple count.
Yeah, and it's really hard to beat that. I mean,
you can choose
really
your friends, but not your family. Boom. Fantastic Four.
And it gets more intense as you look at the specifics of any issue. And we were talking earlier this evening about this video that's online of this show for Sci-Fi Channel where Stan Lee was looking at the original art for Fantastic Four 12. Right. And at one point in this video, this guy is showing him all this art. And there's this panel where it's the thing climbing up a building. And Stan Lee says, oh, you know, here I can tell that I had a panel where I could put a bunch of dialogue, but I really wanted this idea where it looks like he's in the middle of a building. It's a real long panel, so I only put one word balloon there because I wanted to see the scope and the shape. And when Kirby was doing cartooning and where people were doing cartooning, then they would cram a bunch of information in a certain space. They would draw a bunch of stuff in a certain space, and you saw a visual metaphor for whatever was happening these days. And these days, there are a lot of things I like about modern comic art in terms of it looks like a movie script in there or a movie storyboard, and there are beats in that, and you get a lot more character stuff out of that. But you don't get that metaphor. You know, those mm-hmm. kind of core concepts don't come through in every panel and every moment like they did back then when they were simpler.
But I mean, and I think the really good guys, and a lot of times you see this in the indie guys, get that, you know, like they sort of get that metaphor. And I'll always remember this when I worked as Marvel an intern. Klaus Janssen one time came in, and this is amazing.
Klaus is the best guy ever.
And I'm an intern at Marvel, and I'm just like this kid. I have my portfolio, and I come in every day with my portfolio in hopes of like sort of impressing Ralph Macchio or whoever, Tom Brevoort, or whoever's my editor that day. And Klaus would just be like, hey, let's go have a conversation. He was just cool like that. And I had this shot where I had a guy stand on the edge of a ridge on a building with the idea of he's going to jump off this building. It's like Suicide Batman is trying to prevent him from killing himself. And Klaus said, you're trying to show the weight of the world on this guy. I had an upshot, and Klaus said, make it a downshot, because the whole building is above him. I thought, fuck, I would never. I'm 19 years old, whatever. Yeah. I never would have thought of how brilliant that is. If I shot it from above, the whole weight of that building is coming down on that guy. That's so fucking smart, you know? Like, and these early guys, they knew that about comics. I think there are artists who know that now, John Romita Jr. and Stuart Eyman and whatever. But I think you end up sort of being slave to, you know, whatever we have to show this issue. And if that means I got to sell this page to an art collector, or I got to fucking show Deadpool in a cool shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and I'd even go as far as, I mean, you know, the coloring. You know, back then it was simple coloring. You had very simple palettes.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times it was even more effective than a lot of today's coloring, where you see, you know, the you know, Skittle coloring of computer sure. coloring.
The unlimited
like,
color palette.
Yeah, and I it's think, just like everything's so high rendered.
I would love
and
to see more comics art. Go back to a limited color
But then
palette.
You look at something like, well, you know, like I have here Parker, you know, the
two colors.
Yeah, it's like two color, and he does more with those two colors than a lot of guys
well,
do.
Well,
the
Jason book that we were talking about, that I killed Adolf Hitler.
But it's just like, it's like boiling it down to the simple, you know, the simplest nature of it and using that in telling your story instead of like covering up your lack of storytelling ability with all the bells and whistles. And
talking about that Klaus Janson moment that you had, which is amazing. My my favorite New York Comic Con experience was I was at the iFanboy booth, and I was there with Phil Hester, and he was doing, you know, he was there for, I don't know, an hour to do a signing. And this young feller comes up and says, "Hey, would you be able to look at some of my work?" And this kid was a student at the Kubert School, so he's, you know, serious about one day becoming a comic book artist. And to sit there and watch Phil Hester spend about 20 minutes with this kid, talking about his art and how he can, you know, improve, you know, to the point that He took the kid's pages and he said, "Do you have some scratch paper in your book?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he took it out, and Phil basically, you know, did, you know, traced over some of the panels that he had, and it's like, "Well, in this scene, you want to make this the focus, and you want to bring it to the forefront."
Phil's definitely one of those guys. I remember years ago, he was teaching at Wizard World. Here he was teaching
just to understand how much of a storyteller he is and breaking down panels. It was amazing to watch.
Yeah, he did a little panel on thumbnailing,
mm-hmm.
and how to use thumbnails, and it was one of the most educational half hours I've ever spent with somebody, you know, talking about comics. Because Phil's really incredibly bright when it comes to that. So, I mean, he knows story. He knows how to.
You know, it's, you know, how do you, whenever you tackle a page, Tim, there are these tips, and to sit there and watch Phil, you know, talk to this kid about this is, you know, we talk all the time. It's like, this artist is a great storyteller. I mean, you were talking about the Darwin Cook, the outfit, and I think that everyone kind of like inherently just knows that Darwin Cook is an amazing storyteller, just in his panel layouts and how he progresses things. He's just an amazing storyteller. You know, who are the guys in the industry for you, Tim, that you look at and you're like, "Man, this guy tells a great story."
The toughest thing about doing mainstream comic book work is that when you learn about storytelling, you don't really look at a lot of modern superhero guys. You look at, the best storytelling stuff is like Will Eisner and Charles Burns and Wally Wood. Charles Burns. Charles Barks, absolutely, too.
Oh, Charles Barks.
But Charles Barks, too.
Okay.
I mean, it's talking about Charles Burns. Uncle Scrooge, Charles Burns.
Okay.
But you look at this stuff, and it's like, here's the thing that sells, right? And you've got to do, you look at... Like, even though Jim Lee does a really good, he's a pretty good
great draftsman. Incredible draftsman.
Great draftsman. Yeah. There are things that he does with splash pages and all these sort of things, or Michael Turner or David Finch, where you're like, these are the popular artists, but they actually kind of go against a lot of the things that you were taught as being like great storytelling moments. Because, you know, you're always sort of in that level of like, do I do the thing that best serves the story or the best serves the sort of fan reaction, right? And that's tough, you know. It's like,
is Michael Bay the best director out there? Well, his movies make a shit ton of money.
I know.
You know what I mean?
The box office says yes.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know what I mean?
But I mean, technically speaking, he's pretty unskilled. But I mean, a lot of these guys have they sort of skirt this middle line, and you know, you can't deny the sort of like a visceral accessibility of a Rob Liefeld comic or the sort of powerful effect of a Jim Lee comic, or the like, I'm amazed by the detail of a Jeff Darrow or of a Dave Finch comic. Wherein, technically, if you're going for ultimate storytelling ability and you're going for accessibility and sort of like, do I get the moments? Maybe it's not the most sort of academic version of that.
Well,
so you always have to skirt that sort of level. Yeah. It's like, I mean, when I, you know, when I write something, this, and I've had this, I had this with Ant-Man and Wasp or anything else I write for myself, the writer part of me is such an asshole because I never write anything for me to fucking excel as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I put in 3 issues of Ant-Man and Wasp, I put one fucking splash page in. One fucking splash page. You know, if I was a guy who was trying to be sort of more commercial, more accessible, if I were a Jeff Loeb, I would say, okay, artists sell books. I'm going to put space for Jay Scott or Dave Finch or Ed McGuinness to draw the shit
McGuinness,
out of
McGuinness, whoever, right. Yeah.
And I never do that for myself. I always, I'm way too
Why
concerned.
Why not, Tim?
I'm way too concerned about the individual beat moments to do that for myself. That sounds fucked up, but writer me is way more anal than artist me. That's just the way I roll. But I mean, it's interesting to see like what fans respond to, and maybe not academic, but it's certainly powerful. I'm a McFarlane and a Rob Liefeld and mm-hmm. Jim Lee fan, but academically, it's not always super accurate.
Do you think splash pages get overused?
They do. They were supposed to be. I mean, the intent when Jack did it, Jack invented the splash page.
Okay.
Jack Kirby. And the intent when he did it was for huge cinematic, huge moments. Effect. Huge yeah. moments that you built up to. And it got translated to
6 pages, you know, of the Batcave. Not to rip on Jim Lee, but it that's what it turned into.
It became the reveal page.
Yeah.
Where it used to be, the reveal page might be 12 panels on one page and 7 panels on the next.
Well, I think it turned into the reveal page, and it also turned into the, I can sell the splash page for a shitload of money.
No, yeah, secondary market. The guy who I think everybody should really check out, if you're an artist and you want to learn about things you should do, and I don't know if he's doing it as much anymore, but Eddie Campbell used to do a blog back in the day, and what he would write on his blog, I remember he wrote a whole sequence, and these days, like I said, when you think about how certain people do comic pages, they'll do it looks like a movie storyboard where it's these long, widespread panels, and it's one guy who's running, and there's a shitload of speed lines, and then the next panel is the guy who's chasing him, and it's like to the left, and it's a bunch of speed lines. But Eddie Campbell did a thing once, I remember, where he was saying, look, if you want to do a story about one guy chasing another, every panel should have both guys in it, because the visual story is about the relationship between these two people, and you want to frame that image together, you know? And a bunch of things like that you don't think about because
depends on what effect you're going for too.
But I mean,
not every story
is we're also influenced by manga in current American comics, which they would never do both people
in the same panel. Never.
So I mean, you can kind of call it out as being, you know, this is not sort of about the relationship, but you know, in manga we would have focused on the tear coming down the guy's face.
Single tear. Ant-Man single tear.
It was interesting. Yeah. You know, you're talking about the relationship between, you know, academic and popular is kind of what everyone considers good, and then what people actually buy. And it was interesting. I was just reading a study that was done on this, and part of the study was they had these people and they gave them a choice of films to
this
watch.
This is awesome.
And he said, okay, you pick 3 films. On the first day, you have to pick one film. On the second day, you pick another film. On the third day, you pick the third film, but you pick them all today. So
you pick the three,
and then you tell me which one you're going to watch today, which one you're going to watch tomorrow, which one you're going to watch on the third day. Something like 85% of the people all picked Shawshank Redemption as one of their 3 films.
Really?
But about 70% of those people picked it as their third day film and never watched it, because they all knew they should watch it because they know it, you know, they've been told it was a good movie, won all sorts of Academy Awards, and they know they should watch it for their own good. But in reality, on the first day and the second day, what they watched was Speed and, you know, whatever, you know, whatever.
I mean, how do you fault that?
It's the difference between what we, you know, logically what we know is good for us and what is actually
good.
good, not good, but what is actually
more in depth or more looks at the human condition,
just
or whatever.
Just enough
else.
To just easy yeah. to take, well, easy I mean, to consume. It's part of
it's the McDonald's Happy Meal versus the you know the really healthy home cooked meal.
Going to food, another part of the study was food. They asked all these people. They said, okay, a week from now, I'm going to give you a choice. You can either have a plate of carrots. Or no, a plate of apples, sliced apples, or a piece of cake. What do you choose? What will you choose a week from now? And the majority of the people said, I'll take the carrots, the apples.
Yeah.
But then a week later, they all took the cake. Because it's the immediacy of it as opposed to...
And how do you fault
that? Yeah, I mean, you know. So it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, we know what we should like or what is good for us, regardless of entertainment or anything else. But the reality is, hey, you know what? Sometimes I just want to sit down and just watch guys, you know, hit each other. Well, I just want to watch wrestling. I don't want to watch Shawshank Redemption.
Well, I had this weird thing because before I was married, I mean, you know, I don't want to say I'm pretentious, but I think I've learned that post being married. But I would never, you know, come home and watch shit TV. I would never do that. I would never be like, I come home and I'll watch fucking bad sitcoms or reality TV. I would never do that in my life. I never chose that. But I might come home and be like, I will watch, you know, a couple horror movies or whatever, whatever. But since I've gotten married, I don't have a very big house. I come home and my wife will be like, oh, I had an awful day. And my wife, when she has an awful day, wants to watch, you know, Bridezillas or...
Because she doesn't have to think
about
it. Jersey
Licious.
She just wants to take her mind off it. Right. She doesn't want to think about it. She doesn't want to...
But my choice when I watch anything is not to not think. But I think about it, I have a great job I love. So I don't have to do that.
Well, so, I'll tell you, eight years ago, I would, you know, watch all the best movies. I would, you know, I read tons of books. I consumed, you know, literature and took my time and studied things. Then I had kids. And now I come home, I work, and then I see my kids for a couple of hours. And at 9 o'clock at night, when they finally get, you know, fight them to get them in bed, and, you know, between breaking them up from, you know, killing each other and arguments and everything, the dogs and the house, and my wife tells me there's something wrong with her. You know, I just put on The Big Bang Theory. I don't want to fucking think.
I don't want to deal with me 8 hours a day.
Yeah, exactly. I don't, you know, it's like, I don't want to fucking use my brain anymore. It's been stressed out.
The weird approach, I think what I learned about it, because both my parents are middle class. Neither of my parents went to college. My mom, you know, every night came home and watched Designing Women and fell asleep on the couch. And my dad every night watched House 2 and fell asleep on the chair downstairs. And my approach has always been, I want to slip
every
in.
Every night he watched House 2?
Well, whatever. He loved that fucking movie.
I like that movie, but damn.
Maybe Troll 2.
That's kind of fucked Troll up. Yeah.
Too. Whatever House great, two. You know, shitty fucking
People Under
thing.
The Stairs,
he
too.
He never watched TV, but he always watched movies. But
The Hills Have Eyes again.
Again.
Yeah. Right. They will come back.
So I think that has influenced the way I do things. Is that's why I end up doing something not like, you know, Jason's sort of Israeli approaches to World War II or whatever. And why, but I always try to do things that are like, hey, this is deceptively brainless, but it has a moment of sort of, let's think about it.
Intellectuality.
And that's because I love those things that challenge me. But I know that most people don't want to see that all the time. And so I don't want to make, even though I love the shit out of something super challenging like, you know, like a Charles Burns book or whatever. I would also really like to enjoy something for the pure visceral level of dudes punching heads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what if we combine both those things? And I think, you know, you're right. I think that's why I always do like things like Hack Slash or Love Bunny. It's like half ass punch face shit, fuck whatever, and then moment of humanity. And maybe that's the sort of influence.
See, I thought you were just doing it to get laid. That's what I...
I'm married. I'm married. I can't do shit to get laid.
Hack Slash for years before you were married. So.
I never got laid from Hack Slash until my wife. And that was it was a year after I started. So okay, now right. I probably could...
And it had nothing to do with the comic.
No. Well, no, she was in the play. So technically it has to do with the play. But now I could probably reap some ass rewards, but I'm married, so it's no fucking good.
Shit.
Damn.
Whatever.
No, I was about to say, it's really weird because I remember thinking this a few years ago, and it's a thought I've had in my mind a while. I went to SPX, and I went to the panel that was like about comics criticism, and Gary Groth was on the panel. And mm-hmm. Gary is a guy who, like, I get the feeling whenever I interact with him. Well, no. I've got the feeling whenever I interact with him, like, to him, if he's absorbing storytelling or media of any kind, he wants it to be sobering, serious shit about the human condition that makes him think about the pressure of life, yeah. Which is like amazing stuff. But it's like, man, I can't imagine being a person who wants to read that shit.
That's the only thing you want. Yeah, I can't read a serious polyp every night.
Yeah,
you know, it's great. I talked about this on 11 o'clock this week. You know, I love those books. I loved a serious polyp and three story. I've been reading The Sixth Gun, and god damn are those fun comics. Yeah. It's, you know, give me
Colin Bunn, motherfucker.
Oh man, they're so good. I want to see a good face punch from time to time.
Well, I mean, but I think there's a level of which I see Jersey Shore on TV and I scoff and I say, fuck you, America, you think this is good, you're fucking retarded. On the other hand, I couldn't watch the most serious of things. I can't watch Jersey Shore because it's the lowest common denominator. It's the dumbest thing ever. But I couldn't watch the smartest thing ever all the time. You know, it's like I have to have that sort of like...
something in between Jersey Shore and Nova.
Marvel Comics.
You know?
Yeah. I think I found, for me anyway, the perfect balance in shows for that is Mythbusters. Funny, they stupid. Know it. They, you know, they fall. They, you know, guys get hit in the nuts.
But then there's
some science, and they're talking about physics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they know it too, man. They know that.
Oh, yeah. They got it down.
It's for pseudo smart people.
Yeah, it's a pseudo intellectual.
Even though we
just call me pseudo smart. That's not nice.
Yes, it's.
Well, you're American. You're pseudo smart.
You know, we had talked about a fairly smart show. Have you all seen Sherlock yet? The BBC Sherlock?
No, I hear it's really good though.
It's really, really good. And there's only three of them, and the first one is really good. The second one is probably the weakest of the three, but the third one, have you had a chance
to watch? I have not watched the third one yet.
The third one's fucking awesome.
The first one I thought was great, and yeah. Very good, very good.
So, I mean, that's just good, smart TV.
Well, there's that's a perfect example of like, oh, well, that's, you know, Sherlock Holmes has been around for how many years, and yeah, here's another take.
At least 30.
And, sure. Yeah, and how many movies? At least 30 years.
There's a movie last year.
Yeah.
But well, speaking that's of, like, of the ultimate combination of smart and dumb, BBC. I mean,
yeah.
Britain, Benny Hill. England, yeah, has some of the dumbest TV shows I've ever seen in my life. Dumber than any American TV show.
Oh, God. Most of the dumb TV shows in America originated in Great Britain.
But I think you have to have a balance. Also have some of the smartest. Yeah. I mean, you know, they really fucking rule.
It surprised me with Sal because he knows I enjoy most things British, and you have I am an Anglophile,
yes.
And you have a disdain for most things British.
Yes.
And so I was, honestly, I was really timid about trying to turn you on to Sherlock because you're going to be like, oh, fucking BBC.
Well, no, I don't have a problem. Like, Sherlock is fine because, you know, it's like that it originated. It was originally British. It's like James Bond. I can't complain about, you know, a British James Bond. You know what I mean? I can't complain about British Sherlock Holmes, but it's like some of the other things I don't.
But the biggest sleaze tabloid bullshit comes from England.
Oh yeah,
the best, most intelligent stuff also comes from England, which makes me appreciate England in a weird way. That
it's an interesting little island,
right? We're also we basically in America. We come from like second to the dumbest and second to the smartest, so we're just like in the middle.
America is if you took England and like fed it with Miracle-Gro for like 200 years.
Literally, that's exactly what it is. It's always funny to see. I used to think, you know, I think a lot of Americans maybe think, did you watch BBC or you listen to great BBC radio, and you think, God, they did much smarter stuff.
I think it's just the accent.
No, it's not. It's not even because you watch their really worst shit, and they have the biggest tabloid sleazeball, bullshit, dumbest people ever TV shows you've ever seen, and you go, oh no, wait, this is why we're colonial to them. We are exactly like them, except moderately more like in the middle. Like they have more extreme bullshit and smart than we do.
But I don't know if that's true. I think we've just put our efforts into
I mean, American Idol comes from England, so, you know,
yeah,
that tells you how dumb
a
things
are. A lot of the reality television comes from
England. England, yeah, so yeah, absolutely.
Big Brother,
absolutely.
Yeah, but I tell you, you know.
What are the genius from England? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Back to comics, I think some of the greatest comic book creators of all time are British.
We're going to talk about Alan Moore now?
Hey, you know, you can run down the list. You know, there are an amazing list of both artists and writers that are British.
But sure, I mean, absolutely. But the UK has also given us some of the dumbest shit. So, you know,
yeah.
Props. Well, are you a 2000 AD fan?
I mean, I think it works. I've enjoyed a lot of it.
Someone in this room has referred to it as incredibly overwritten. I will not say who that person is.
I'll tell you what. I grew up on British stuff. I always thought British stuff was better. And then I go back and read a lot of it, and I go, oh, no, it's just hateful of the audience. And that's fine. And a lot of it is hateful of the audience. A lot of the guys that we really sort of praise now are actually just completely hateful of the people who read it. And
really?
Yeah, actually, absolutely. I mean, some of the biggest British or UK stars now are hateful of the audience. Some of them are Grant Morrison. You know, some of them are Grant Morrison and are so smarter than us and have so many brilliant ideas that we can.
It's really interesting to me though how many British guys are interested in making a commentary on America, you know, or like, you know, whatever they want. Those guys want to come. They want to do a story about Superman. They want to do a story that involves Captain America.
Well, this is what. But this is why I was talking about. You know, you're saying, oh, they have the smart. They have like the higher level of smarter people.
No, they don't. Because we have smart guys too.
I'm just saying. I think it's just a matter of we've found easier ways to make money, and that's what we've put our efforts into. If science was the number one way, or literature was the number one way to make money in this country, you'd see a lot of smart motherfuckers showing their stuff.
No, I mean, I think you look at, you know, what they tend to do, and it tends to be because they didn't grow up. Well, wait, one generation of Brits didn't grow up on superhero books, and it really is by generation. So Alan Moore came from a generation where they got only reprints, and by the time the 80s came around, he'd only seen 10 years previous. He saw 70s stuff, and it was like reprints of other stuff. But you had guys who were literally like 10 years behind, but were a little bit more adult by the time they saw, you know, Superman or whatever. I have a burp right now. But anyway, when you look at like the way the British approach things, it's literally just because they had other things. I mean, you know, Garth Ennis now grew up on 2000 AD. So why does he love? He loves military stuff and all those sort of things. And primarily in the United States, we grew up on superheroes, and that's the way it is. 20 years from now, I don't know if there would be a sort of disconnect between Brit writers and American writers because they were all reading manga.
Have you guys read Clint yet at all?
I have not.
It is really, really interesting, that magazine. It fascinates me in a way in which I cannot describe.
More so than Dodge and Logic?
More so than Dodge and Logic, because
really?
Clint
really?
Is really, there are certain ways in which it is a perfect Mark Miller magazine, in which it is very low ball, you know, like here are our spread of hot moms, here is our, you know, kind of very, you know, kind of, you know.
He frustrates me so much because
you like him and you can't help it.
Well, no, I don't know.
Expectations that you're retarded.
That's a really good, absolutely.
Like, great ideas, but I don't want to give you any more credit than you're a fucking mouth-breathing retard.
but he's framed that whole magazine in this way, in which, you know, there is a history of British comics. There was Eagle back in the 30s and 40s, and there were adventure comics that way.
Before
American comics started to become shipped over.
Right, exactly. I mean, exactly. We invented it, but they did their own thing.
They did their own thing for a while, and then at a certain point, 2000 AD came in the late 70s and through the 80s was the giant thing in which all these guys kind of, you know, however you want to say, be vulgar, busted their nut, and then they all came to America, and then into the 90s, 2000 AD kind of crested and went down, and this is trying to be, you know, the next big thing. But it's really weird how there are a lot of interesting and unique Britishisms about how editorially that magazine works, about how Mark Miller presents himself in that magazine, and then the main strips on it are, you know, it's reprinting Turf, which is Jonathan Ross doing a Vampires meets Prohibition America strip. There is Frankie Boyle, who's a British comedian who's very British and is not known at all in America, doing a strip which is his take on Lex Luthor, which is a really super superhero American-oriented strip, and it's Miller reprinting Kick-Ass, reprinting Nemesis, reprinting American Jesus, which is what he's renamed Chosen. So it's this really kind of weird balancing point, and I'm wondering how... I'd like to see that. I'd like to see any kind of broader mass media magazine for comics do well, and I'd like to see Clint do well for the British market. And his goal has been to put it out into newsstands and to put it out for people. But I'm wondering how will that market, how will the young people in Britain these days absorb that magazine, and what will it make when the people who are making it are obviously very influenced by American media, very influenced by American comics.
But you know, Judge Dredd took place in the United States.
Yeah, it did.
Here's the thing. I mean, the reality of the colonial and versus Britain thing has always been that we're in love with a hate love relationship with each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it works. So Watchmen is a distillation of American comics, whereas fucking Judge Dredd is a distillation of American politics and crime.
And it's weird. It's weirder than that. There are ways in which, I mean, you know, like Watchmen, like you say, is about American politics explicitly, but there are also, I mean, it's about Thatcherism in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
And if you
watch
the
Vendetta,
is totally about Thatcherism. But if you watch the ways in which,
it's the 5th of November as we record this.
It is.
Remember the 5th of November.
but these days, you know, you look at the Iraq War and how much, people in Britain are going to look at Tony Blair in terms of that, the same way we're going to look at George W. Bush, and the ways in which the two cultures are still so connected. And so there's a way in which they'll never separate back out. You know,
absolutely.
Even though they might take our specific superheroes is a cultural touch point and make their thing, in which way they're still making it their own thing. And it's a weird back and forth in that way.
You could write a book about that, I think, and that was some interesting points you brought up. But I think the colonial and British stuff is a mutual fascination.
Yeah.
We're interested in the way that they do things because it's different, but it's also very similar. You know, we're all Anglican. We're all sort of the same. You know, we get our versions of politics from them, but we in turn are a much bigger country and influence them. And, you know, yeah, I mean...
I have no interest in them.
I had this weird thing. When I went to Italy, I get stuck in a foreign country with, like, people from France and all these other countries. And, you know, if you get stuck in a country with 40 other people, you and the Brits are the best friends on earth. Because here's the thing. Like, you got some French and some fucking Italians, like a bunch of Italians, and maybe some, like, Bolivians and, like, whatever, some Serbians. And you find a Brit, and you're like, we are the same. And you both go looking for a pub, and you both sit down, and you can get... It's weird how well you relate to Brits, even though you have, your countries aren't the same, but they really are. It's weird how Brits are your friends, and
you think the other countries are weird in all the same ways.
Yeah, and that you Brits. I mean, it in about 5 minutes you can understand everything different about a British person, but what they speak, you can figure it out in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird, and I had this experience where it was like I'm stuck in this country where I've got some South Africans, some Serbians, and they kind of speak English, and some Italians who kind of speak English, but your best friends are now English because they understand you, they watch your movies, you grew up with their movies. The only thing different is maybe they say some Cockney shit you don't understand, but they can explain it to you in a minute and a half. And, you know, it's like...
They really like sausage and fried fish.
They refer to it as a lift or a flat.
Well, do you think it's
they're gonna stand in a queue?
But we love what they love. They love what we love.
Don't you think it's sort of like a mutual admiration, but hidden, like a hidden? This may make completely no sense whatsoever. But and feel free to edit this out if I make no sense. But I mean, looking in generalities, going back to what you were talking about, Kyle. You know, the back and forth between comics, superhero comics, British comics, but then the back and forth. But I mean, you see that in other mediums, music, obviously,
sure.
The back and forth, rock and roll, you know, punk, that kind of stuff, films.
Absolutely.
So you see that back and forth, and do you think it's sort of like, you know, we look at the British in a certain light of. We want to be like them in certain ways, and vice versa. Like
absolutely.
The Americans have, we have this Americans have a sort of wild ass hair, like you know, crazy rebel sort of thing.
I think there was like a parent child relationship for a long time, and it's not quite that anymore. But
I think it's like you have your older brother and then the younger, crazy fucking, you know.
Yeah.
And in one way, you really are jealous of your younger brother because he's off, you know, like in Mexico, you know, getting drunk on tequila and banging whores. But at the same time, But at the same time, like, he's looking up at his older brother going, oh, shit, I should be more responsible.
And I think that the Brits have always been really good at pointing out things in Americans that Americans relate to. They can see it from the outside, but they see it with the amount of understanding that we couldn't get from someone from France or whatever. There's a reason that in American comics, like in our country, who the hot writers are either English or American. That's it. We don't have fucking hot French writers. Why? Because there's a very simple...
They speak fucking French.
and their culture is very different.
But when you hear Grant Morrison talk about why All-Star Superman is about the promise of America, or, you know, all these kind of
they get
ideas.
Us and we get them.
Yeah.
And there's a real... I mean, that's why, you know...
You guys are making me not hate the British as much.
No, they are us. I mean, there is no way around it. I think the reality of, like, you look at the most popular TV shows, and you look at House, and you look at our best actors that we really respect, they are always colonial-based. They're Australian, or they're British. But we see ourselves in them, but we see a reflection of us. And that is what makes... That is what always gives me faith in the United States, is that we're willing to sort of look outside and see different versions of ourselves.
I think the sibling,
unless they're Mexican,
right,
of course.
I said the mother, father, and kid, but the British really are like siblings. I think
absolutely,
and
they know it. I mean, literally in those situations where I've been placed with. I'm an American. I'm with Brits. Look, we seek each other out, man. You know, it's like, in a weird way, I'm in Europe. And
we love beer and sport.
Yeah. You know, when I was in, I'm in Italy, and like, those Brits are looking for me because they know I want to go drink it. And they know that Italians don't want to do that. They know that Italians don't even have fucking bars in their country. So, like, in this weird way, Brits are like, hey, mate, you know, let's go fucking tear it up because I know you're American. You like a fucking pub.
Yeah.
And...
We'll watch any sort of football, American or otherwise.
Yeah. And we'll give high fives. We'll fucking get shit-faced. We'll
play some
fun
darts,
of
and it'll be good.
And
the interesting thing I'll say is that I found a lot of guys who I've met from Britain. Like, one guy I know who I own email with, if you're listening to this, Rob Williams, who does a lot of stuff. He's way into the NFL. Yeah. Super into the NFL.
How many Americans do you know that are really into soccer?
You know who else? Fucking Anthony Johnston.
Oh, no. Anthony Johnston is a friend of Robert Lindsay. He's a good guy too.
Anthony Johnston.
They're more into football than I am. I don't even watch football.
I'm asking Anthony. I'm in New York and asking Anthony Johnston about. We're in a cab and I'm asking him about either. Like, are you a rugby or a soccer guy? And he's like, neither. I'm like, what? He's like, I'm a Dolphins fan. It's like, what the fuck out? Really?
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're gonna see in the one of the cool things about comics is we're always ahead of the game, right? Before. In a weird way, and this is the cool thing about comics, because it's cheaper and faster and everything else about it. We were Anglophiles before the rest of culture. We had hired Alan Moore to write fucking shit and make it awesome. We had the bad girl craze before they did. We had zombies before the mainstream did. We are literally the cultural thermometer. And if people were smarter, they would take our anal temperature a lot faster.
I was going to say, it's an anal thermometer.
Right.
Well, I think they're trying. I think it is getting quicker and quicker.
But
though.
It is actually, literally, if you want to take the fucking flavor of what's going on, check comics, man. Because you're faster. We can do it better and faster than they can in things that cost more money. Literally, if you really look at it, what do you think it cost Kirkman to make Walking Dead number one?
To make it?
$2,000.
Well, he probably didn't pay Tony shit, so...
Yeah. He got money in the back end. The whole thing probably cost $2,000, $4,000 tops. But here's the wonder of that. You take the cultural thermometer, it takes off, costs you $4,000. To make that same thing for TV or film costs you millions of dollars.
And this is... I wanted to go back to a point you had brought up before, Kyle. You had sort of, you know, taken a shot at people that, you know, maybe come to comics and write something specifically...
As a pitch. Yeah.
And I understand
we've seen enough of that.
Yeah, but you know, but I've sort of started to rethink the my disdain of that kind of thing because it's like, well, it's not a bad idea to do that, first of all.
No. I mean,
it's like, what's better? Something tangible that you can show someone that, A, could have been, you know, actually has sales
numbers. But are you
asking
for people to fund your pitch?
But I guess it depends on how much a snob you want to be about art. You know, capital A art.
Well,
you
know,
even the worst comics that are done by people who consider themselves cartoonists first or consider themselves comic creators first, they are interested in comics. And I think the problem is if somebody comes, and I interview these people a lot during the day, I interview a lot of guys who maybe start as film screenwriters or they start as crime novelists, but they love comics and they come into comics because not just because they think they can get it sold, but also because they think, I dig comics. I'm into it. You know, I've interviewed Victor Gishler, who's doing X-Men right now, and
yeah, but you don't have to love comics to make comic books. I mean,
No. But I think there's a lot of people who make comics who literally take their screenplay and they say, "Hey, artist, figure out how to fucking put this on the page."
Sure. Well,
you know,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing you want to discourage against.
I think you just have to judge everything on its own merit, not necessarily. Oh well,
that's how Stan did it.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. It's like We all of a sudden hold comic books up to this some sort of imaginary standard that doesn't really exist, because I've talked to enough comic book creators that do it for a living. They don't hold it up to that standard. It's only us as fans that hold it up to something that isn't realistic or has ever existed in the medium.
I almost vehemently disagree, but I appreciate that you've got that different standard. But I think, and maybe it is because, like you said earlier, there's a thing in which comic fans are really precious about comics and really want comics to succeed in a certain way. But I mean, I am protective of comics as an art form in and of themselves. And so whenever I see somebody who comes in and wants to look at comics only as a way to exploit that cheaper, easier, more accessible medium in order to get themselves something else,
I agree with you. It's whenever it goes beyond creating it for what it is. Whenever you say, you know, here, I'm going to give this to the artist, and you draw it how you want to, and then we'll figure it out later. This is a theoretical situation.
Yeah.
I agree with Kyle. It's like, you know, make comics for comics' sake, not as the first step.
Exactly.
If I get the impression from you that you're making a comic, I don't want it to be transmedia.
If I get the feeling from you that you're making a comic and you'll be happy with, I made an awesome comic, it never gets picked up as anything else, but I'm really glad I got to tell this story in some way, that's fine.
That has nothing to do with whether or not it's a good story. That has nothing to do with whether, and that's all I
but
want.
I don't give a shit why you're doing it.
Just tell me a good story. It doesn't matter if your aspiration is for you to have a franchise of 13 films and sell toys. If that's what you want, go for it. All I want is a good story. I don't care what your intention is.
As a person who has read a lot of these comics that have been made for X, Y, or Z reasons, I find qualitatively that a lot of people who do this shit don't end up making good stories.
Right. I mean, there are certainly movie pitches that made great comics, but the thing is, you can usually tell is when you see something that's a movie pitch, it's like, I had this script and it really wasn't made for comics, and it's drawn by a guy who I paid a shit amount of money, and he made this
kind of fucking half-assed crap.
And that you can see that. Certainly, if you accidentally made a great comic book on the way to a movie pitch, I can't fault you.
But how often does that happen?
Hey, 30 Days a Night.
I don't know.
Steve Niles originally conceived 30 Days a Night as a movie, and it's a fucking awesome comic. I think it's a way better comic than it ever was as a movie.
Agreed. Agreed. It's more style. I mean, that's a lot of that might be Ben.
I think it's a pretty good movie, though.
But it's a good movie.
It's a fine movie.
It's one of my dad's favorite movies. My dad saw that movie and said, "Did you ever see that? You ever read that comic?" I'm like, "Yeah, I know that guy. Oh fuck, that was a great movie." You know what I mean? But like,
pass me a High Life.
Yeah. Cheers to my dad. I'm gonna drink some High Life right now. But I mean, I think there's a certain reality of like, it might sound weird for me to say it's the guy who sold the fucking comic as a movie, but how I can tell it's different is, you know, if I only want to do Hack Slash and sell it as a movie, I would have fucking quit and done something else. I would have sold this movie and I said, fuck this, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to do something I can sell again.
Come up with another pitch.
I was so compelled by those comics, and I want to do comics about things I love, that I was going to keep doing that comic. And 6 years later, I'm still fucking doing that goddamn comic to my own lament and, you know...
I think there can be something in between there. No, you know what I mean? I don't think everybody that makes a comic has to be... I love comics. I'm going to do it whether anyone reads it or not.
Not everybody makes a film loves film.
I don't think it's like, I don't agree that there's a litmus test, but I think that if somebody says, I really wanted to make a movie, I'll look at that comic more suspect.
As well you should. And there are certainly companies that exist to make movie pitches, and you can tell.
Well, and they come right out and say it. You know?
But I think we're all in agreement that it doesn't matter as long as you're telling a good story.
Just tell me a good story. That's what I'm saying is just tell me a good story. I don't give a shit why. I don't care what your intention is. All I care about is a good story. And, I'm going to bring it back
to where we started as we wrap up here.
We're wrapping up already? It's so early.
We're 2 hours. We're over 2 hours in. I know it's 8 months off, and the guy.
It seems
wants
like
to talk
you guys
forever.
Had a lot to say, and you really could have done more. I mean, I don't think Colin and I made it easier for you.
No. Well, I'm gonna bring it back to the beginning, and we have The Walking Dead, which is a fantastic comic, which tells a great story, and now we have the TV adaptation of it.
That was a movie pitch from the beginning.
Yeah, obviously, obviously. Yeah. But I think that's
but it really
a, that,
wasn't.
That, yeah. that that's a great lesson is that you have a great comic that has turned into what is hopefully going to be a great TV show, and it's boiling it down. It's telling good stories. A good story is a good story. Just do that.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, I want to thank our guest for tonight.
Totally farted, by the way.
I don't know if he showed up. I heard it where I was sitting.
That's like a Miller High Life fart. That's terrible.
I'm sorry.
Creator and gassy creator, Mr. Tim Seeley. We're gonna look for Hackslash as always,
and Ant-Man Wasp.
Ant-Man Wasp.
November 10th. Buy the shit out of that because that will determine whether Marvel ever invites me to do something ever again.
I've seen pages. It looks awesome.
Yeah, if you like it, tell others.
Mr. Kyle Figley, go to Comic Book Resources and read your stuff.
And I will plug, I'm on a blog with some other guys who work in comics, and rather than give you it's called the Cool Kids Table, rather than give you the URL, go to Twitter and it's TheCKT. You can find it that way.
Okay, I'll follow you. All right.
Follow.
At Brian Salazar.
That's me.
On
Fanboy Legion. Go to fanboylegion.com. Oh, buy some patches.
Yes. This episode of Around Comics is brought to you by the Fanboy Legion. All right.
That company's going out of business soon. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I'm hacking Tim Seeley for Twitter, by the way. I don't know.
Hacking Tim Seeley. Hacking. Hey, it's great to be back. We'll be back for December.
Probably.
Yeah. Are we coming?
Hopefully.
We going to squeeze one more fucking month out of it?
We'll be fine. We don't have to make any commitments.
The non-committal aspects of this, but I feel like you guys are on that date where it's like, this is kind of going pretty well.
We're probably going to fuck
on this date. Let's just guarantee that at least we'll get to anal. Like, this is what I feel like you're
Chris
saying.
Chris is trying to close the deal over here.
Yeah.
I'm not that kind of girl, Chris.
I think that he's going to ride you into the sunset. I think Chris is going to fuck you all night. That's what I think this podcast is saying.
No. We're gonna stop there.
I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers, and I'm hoping for Raleigh I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey.
Views expressed by guests of Around Comics are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2010.
Running from the cold up in New England, I was born to be a fiddler in an old time string band. My baby plays a guitar, a big banjo now. All North Country winters keep forgetting me, and I lost my money playing poker, so I had to up and lay. But I ain't a turning back to live that old